Good afternoon. We will begin the hearing in docket TC05-047. It's in the matter of the proceeds from bonds and other security for the benefit of customers of S&S Communications. The time is approximately 1:30 p.m. in the afternoon. The date is May 8, 2007, and the location of the hearing is here in room 412 of the State Capitol Building. I'm Dustin Johnson, Commission Chairman. Commissioners Gary Hansen and Steve Kolbeck are also present. I'm presiding over this hearing. This hearing was noticed pursuant to the Commission's Order for and Notice of Hearing, which was issued March 20th, 2007, and the Supplemental Order for and Notice of Hearing, issued April 27th, 2007. There are three main issues to be decided at this hearing. Number one, whether each claim should be allowed, denied, or consolidated with another duplicate claim. Number two, what share of the S&S proceeds should each claim receive? And number three, what action the Commission should take regarding the 35 shares of Aberdeen Finance Corporation stock and the $2,500 installment payment obligation. All parties have the right to be present and to be represented by an attorney. All persons testifying will be sworn in and subject to cross-examination by the parties. The Commission's final decision may be appealed by the parties to the State Circuit Court and the State Supreme Court. I will note that we are broadcasting on the Internet, and so I would ask all people who are testifying to speak slowly and clearly into the microphone. We also have a reporter here, Ms. Carla Bashan, will act as the court reporter today. Rolaine Weiss, the Commission's counsel, will act as hearing examiner and will conduct the hearing subject to the Commission's oversight. She may provide recommended rulings on procedural and evidentiary matters. The Commission may overrule its counsel's preliminary rulings throughout the hearing. If not overruled, the preliminary rulings will become final rulings. And at this time, I would happily turn the hearing examiner duties over to Ms. Weiss.
Thank you. This is Rolaine Weiss. First, we will take appearances of the parties. Who represents staff in this case?
Thank you, Ms. Hearing Examiner. This is John Smith, counsel for staff. I have here with me today, I think they're with me. If they're not now, they will be. Keith Sanger and Heather Forney, as of this point in time, will be the witnesses for staff.
Thank you. And is there anyone in the audience who is going to appear today, any claimants or otherwise? Okay, the record should indicate there is not. So at this point, I guess I would ask Mr. Smith, do you have any opening statement?
Not really. I do have a couple of, a very brief, and then a little mini preliminary matter, if I might.
Go ahead.
Thank you. As I think the chairman has accurately stated, the purpose of the hearing here today is to consider and hopefully put a very significant amount of resolution on a process that we've been now going through for almost 4 years, and that is the S&S bond proceeds hearing. As Ms. Weiss, I think, stated, or maybe it was the chairman, also we do have the issue of the Aberdeen Finance stock and the $2,500 installment debt that we've also noticed for hearing. And those are the issues before us today. At the outset, I would like to request that the motion that we made be amended, the motion that was served on claimants on March 20th, in one very minor respect that I think you'll comprehend immediately. We recommended that the, as a part of the order, that the executive director be directed to immediately disperse proceeds. We'd like a very slight amendment so that that disbursement would not happen until any appeal time has run. And for very obvious reasons, once we send out this money, it ain't coming back. So just on the off chance, there's nobody here today, and we probably won't have an appeal, but I would recommend that that process await the running of the appeal time. You'll see in an exhibit that will eventually be introduced here, I hope, that coincides pretty well with the end of the term on a couple of CDs that those funds are in right now as well. And with that, I'm going to proceed if it's okay.
And I will grant your motion.
Okay, thank you. At the outset, what I'd like to do is to request that the Commission take judicial notice of the first five exhibits that I would like to offer. And those are exhibits 385, 386, 387, 388, and 389. It's up there. And I don't know, Carla.
Could you state those? I didn't get those all written down.
I'm going to get them all here. They're 385, 386, 387, 388, and 389. And I'll explain to you what those are. The first of those, 385, is the order granting certificate of authority in docket TC00114. That's 385. That's the COA order that granted the COA to S&S in the first place. The second exhibit is 386, which is, it's sitting right here. I myself pulled that from the files this morning after being directed as to its whereabouts by Delaine Coble, who is on. She knows that if we have to, we'll call her up here to certify to it as the custodian of records. What it is the entirety of the record in docket TC02-166. That was the revocation proceeding, the order to show cause, and ultimately revocation proceeding with respect to S&S. The reason why I'd like to have that in is, if you'll note in our motion, we made certain references to that record, particularly with regard to claim fraction and a few other matters that witnesses in that proceeding testified to. Also, it contains a very significant amount of analysis of what happened in this case and how we got to where we're at. And I would like it to be in the record. It's already gone through extensive lawyering to get it there. And just so that that information is available to Ms. Wiest and the commission if you feel you need it to render your findings in order in this case. The next one is 387. That is just the findings of fact, conclusions of law, notice of entry of order in docket TC02-166. And, again, that's a revocation proceeding. The next one is order regarding notice to potential claimants in this docket, docket TC05-047, marked as Exhibit Staff 388. That is the notice that we ultimately sent out on March 20th. And it's an order of the commission. And lastly, this one's a little more unusual, but I have no other way of laying a foundation for it, really. So it's the plan of reorganization, order confirming plan in the case of In Re Aberdeen Finance Corporation, case number 04-10175, U.S. Bankruptcy Court, District of South Dakota. That's marked as Exhibit 389. Those are official records of the United States District Court that we received in the ordinary course of business as a claimant in the Aberdeen Finance case. And with that background, I would move the admission of those five exhibits based on judicial notice.
Madam, if I could. Mr. Smith, the title for 387 was again?
387 is findings of fact, conclusions of law, notice of entry of order in docket TC02-166.
But you've introduced 386 as the entire record.
Oh, wait a minute. I have that. Wait a minute. Oh, the entirety of the dot's 386. That's the, I'm on the wrong. That's 387 is the findings of fact.
And the findings of fact are not a part of the record?
They're not a part of the evidentiary record. They may be in there. They may not. I don't know, honestly. To tell you the truth, I didn't read that whole thing. I didn't look in there. So they might be. And there might be other overlaps as well. That's possible. I'll put it this way. The reason I introduced that whole record is because it's easy. And that way you have it. I don't know exactly precisely what's in there, but it's the entirety of the record in
that
case.
387 functions as insurance.
It's insurance. It's just making sure. And the only purpose for these, really, a lot of the reason is just history and not knowing. I had no idea prior to today what was going to happen here today. I didn't know whether we'd have 50 people in this room or none. And so we had to sort of take a preemptive approach to what we did.
Okay, thanks for the clarification.
Right.
I'm sorry. Those exhibits will be admitted.
Thank you. With that, I would call Keith Singer as our first witness.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony about to give in this cause would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God?
Yes. Keith, would you please state and spell your name for the record?
K Keith Senger, K-E-I-T-H-S-E-N-G-E-R.
Where are you currently employed?
I am currently a utility analyst with the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission.
Could you describe your educational background briefly?
I have an accounting degree from Northern State University. And with minors in economics and management information systems.
And wondering, have you been touching electrical wires before you came in here? Or?
No.
Okay. Prior to joining the commission staff, could you really briefly describe your professional employment history?
I was employed for about 5.5, 6 years by the Department of Legislative Audit, which is the state entity under the legislature that audits the state of South Dakota and various other entities. After that, I worked about a year as the audit manager over at the Department of Transportation, and then I started here at the Public Utilities Commission in January of 99.
At legislative audit, what general types of work did you perform?
Mostly auditing, either compliance auditing or financial auditing of the various departments in the state government.
Did those reviews involve reviewing contracts and similar types of documents?
Yes.
Did those reviews involve determining whether they conformed to laws and rules of the agency?
Yes.
Did they involve determining whether vouchers submitted on contracts were within the scope of what the contract authorized?
Yes.
How about DOT? What did that involve?
That was more the same. Primarily, it was auditing the independent contractors that did work for the Department of Transportation as far as engineer contractors.
So that work also involved analyzing contracts and the data that goes along with them and the and making judgments about those documents.
Correct.
Let's turn to here at the PUC. Can you describe the types of cases generally that you work on here at the PUC?
Electric, natural gas rate cases, telephone rate cases, certificate of authorities, and whatever else gets thrown my way.
With respect to rate case analysis, are these the kind of cases that involve the creation and use of spreadsheet type mathematical models to perform financial analysis, et cetera?
Yes.
And have you had considerable experience in doing that kind of analysis?
Yes, I have.
Would you characterize, based upon the work that you've done using that kind of spreadsheet analysis, would you state that you've developed a high level of expertise in designing and using Excel-type spreadsheets to organize and analyze large amounts of data?
Yes.
Did you utilize that expertise to analyze the information that the commission received from the claimants and other information received by staff related to this proceeding?
Yes.
Moving on to a different type of work then, have you been involved before here at the commission in handling applications by telephone companies for certificates of authority here in South Dakota?
Yes, I have.
Would you say numerous times?
Numerous, yes.
Has your work here at the commission involved interpreting what services are covered and allowed by a certificate of authority?
Yes.
And is this something you've also done many times?
Yes.
I've handed you, Keith, a copy of ARSD 2010-2404.05 entitled Performance Bonds. Are you familiar with this rule of the commission?
Yes, I am.
And have you ever been involved with a certificate of authority application where bonds have been required?
Many times.
Under what circumstances does the commission generally require a bond?
Generally, if the company is collecting deposits, prepayments, or offering any sort of prepaid services, generally the commission requires they provide a bond.
Looking at the end of the last sentence of the first paragraph of that rule, Is it your understanding that the word customer means a customer for the particular telephone service that the commission is authorizing through the certificate of authority that it issues?
Yes.
Have you ever worked on an application for a certificate of authority to provide wireless service here in South Dakota?
No, I have not.
And why is that?
Because we do not have issued certificate of authorities for wireless service.
And is that because neither the commission nor, in fact, the state of South Dakota may do so under the Section 332 of the Federal Telecom Act?
Say that again.
Is that because neither the commission nor the state of South Dakota may exercise such authority under Section 332 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996?
That's correct.
So it follows that we have not required companies to post bonds as a condition of providing wireless service in South Dakota.
That is correct.
Do some of the companies that we provide certificates of authority to also provide services to customers other than the services that the Commission authorizes under the certificate of authority it issues?
Yes.
And those kind of services, do you have examples of what some of those other companies, other services they might provide?
Cable TV, internet services, wireless or cellular services.
So let me ask you this. Is it your understanding then that when we require a company that provides both wireless service and a service that we authorize through a certificate of authority to post a bond, that bond is only applicable with respect to the landline service that we authorize under state law?
That is correct.
When did you first become involved with S&S Communications?
Approximately June or July of 2000 when they filed their original application for a certificate of authority.
Excuse me a minute while I bring these up to him. My own exhibit pile here is pretty disorganized, so pardon me if it takes me a little shuffling here to find things. Showing you staff exhibit 385, that's the certificate of authority that's already been received into evidence. Are you familiar with this order?
Yes, I am.
Directing your attention to the conditions, would you describe the bond coverage under what bond coverage the order required?
The order requires at a minimum of $50,000 surety bond, and that the and 100% coverage for all prepaid amounts under the collateral agreement or the non-recourse agreement as referred to it.
Okay. So the two types of security were either bond coverage or coverage under the non-recourse agreement or the collateral agreement, as it was called in that document.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, now turning your attention to Exhibit 387. That's the decision in TC02-166.
I have it.
Okay, were you involved in that proceeding?
Yes, I was.
And what happened as a consequence? What led to that proceeding, and then what was the result?
This proceeding was brought forth for various reasons, mostly because of S&S Communication failed to provide service on about June 2nd. They quit providing service to all customers.
What effect did S&S's ceasing of operations have on the bonds issued for the protection of S&S customers?
It led the commission to start collecting on those bonds.
In addition to collecting on the bonds, did that also apply to the other kinds of security that we had received?
Yes, it did.
Okay, now I'd like to turn your attention to staff exhibit or Exhibit Staff 390.
I have it.
Okay. Can you walk the commission through that again very briefly and just describe for them what that is? and the various pages, and we can start with page one and walk right through it if you like. I noted in putting this together, I have the dates a little bit. They're not in date order, and for that I apologize. Maybe we want to start.
I could start on page.
Why don't we
three, probably?
Start on page three and four?
Yeah, page three is the original $50,000 bond that SNS provided to the commission for the coverage under the original certificate of authority.
Page five.
Page four.
Or page four, pardon me.
Page four is the notice of cancellation of the $50,000 bond.
Page one.
Page one is a $75,000 bond that actually replaced the $50,000 bond. This bond was determined, the bond coverage went from $50,000 to $75,000 as a result of filing requirements that showed that SNS needed to increase their bond.
And finally, would you turn to page five of the exhibit?
You want to do page two first?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Katie.
Page two is the cancellation of that $75,000 bond.
Okay, that bond was canceled. Do you know, we'll look at another exhibit here in a minute, but was that bond then replaced by another bond?
Yes, that bond was replaced by another $75,000 bond.
From a different company?
From a different company, correct.
Thank you. Next, turning to page five.
Page five is the bond release and assignment. It was the agreement between staff and the company, the allied company, for those two previous bonds I spoke about, in payment of $30,000 in release for any other claims.
And do you know, was that the execution of that release and the settlement of these bond claims or our claims against them approved by the commission?
Yes, it was.
I think my recollection serves me right. Did that occur on or about December 12th of 2006?
That sounds pretty close.
Give or take 2 weeks. Along about that time. Okay. Staff would offer staff 390.
It's admitted.
Thank you. Now turning your attention to Exhibit Staff 391.
I have it.
Would you please describe for the Commission what these two pages of these two documents are?
Page one of Staff Exhibit 391 is a $75,000 bond that replaced the $75,000 bond in the previous exhibit. Page two is the release and assignment of claim in which the commission received $75,000 from collection of that bond.
Thank you. I would offer staff 391.
It's admitted.
Next, turning to staff 392, could you please describe that for the commission?
Staff exhibit 392 is the fourth bond we received. It is a replacement for the bond in staff exhibit 391. It too is a $75,000 bond. And page two again is the release and assignment where the commission received $75,000 in collection of that bond.
Thank you. Staff would offer staff 392.
Exhibit 392 is admitted.
Let's turn now to staff 393, Keith, if you would.
I have it.
Would you please describe what's in this package of materials here? This one is going to be maybe a little bit more involved, but would you tell the commission what page one is?
Yes. Page one is referred to as the irrevocable letter of credit that we received from Aberdeen Finance Corporation.
And when did we receive that?
We received that September 13th, 2002.
Was this irrevocable standby letter of credit ever approved or accepted by the commission?
No, it was not.
But possession of it was maintained by the staff?
Correct.
Did there come a time when this document was presented for payment to Aberdeen Finance Corporation?
Yes.
And did that occur shortly after SNS Communications ceased?
Yes, shortly after SNS ceased providing services, this letter was presented by Commission staff to Aberdeen Finance Corporation for payment.
Now I'd like to call your attention to Exhibit 389, which has already been received into evidence, I think.
I have it.
Looking at that document, would you then take a look at pages 2 and 3 of Exhibit 393?
It appears that this is a front and back document. We only have every other page.
Oh, really? Ooh. I've got, well, we've got a...
Are you talking, what docket number, what staff exhibit, excuse me?
Staff exhibit, this is 393. I have both pages, so we must have...
Oh, on 393 we have everything. You shifted me to 398.
Right.
On 393 we have all the pages.
Okay.
398 I have every other page. Odd numbers.
We'll have to correct 398. Again, that's an official record of the U.S. District Court. 389, pardon me. I think we're fine for now, Heather. You could, please, yeah.
This is the original, but it's not there.
I don't think it makes any difference. They're all just copies, if you want to grab it. Anyway, Keith, I don't know how that occurred in the copying here, but we'll get that fixed. Let's turn to pages 2 and 3 of Exhibit 393, please.
I have it. Page 2 of Exhibit 393 is our certificate for 35 shares of Aberdeen Finance Corporation.
And how did we come by that?
To make a long story short, after we submitted our payment for the $125,000 irrevocable letter of credit to Aberdeen Finance Corporation, payment was not made, and in the end, Aberdeen Finance Corporation filed bankruptcy. The bankruptcy plan called for the commission to receive 35 shares of Aberdeen Finance Corporation equity in lieu of debt of the $125,000 letter of credit.
And following the issuance of the order by the bankruptcy court confirming plan, we received this stock certificate in the mail.
That is correct.
Looking at the order confirming plan again, just calling your attention to it, is that all we received as a result of the letter of credit?
No. We also received $2,500 worth of debt payable in four annual installments. First payment to begin, I think it's either September or October of this year.
Thank you.
The annual payments would be $625 each, if my math is correct.
Thank you. Let's take a look then at page 3 of document 393. Pages 3 and 4. I think you're... Yep.
This would be 4. 4 and 5.
Pardon me, 4 and 5.
Page 4 is a letter from Aberdeen Finance Corporation, Kathy Getty, the Secretary Treasurer. Providing us with a resolution of the board of the stockholders of Aberdeen Finance Corporation.
And could you just, in a couple of sentences, tell us what that resolution was all about?
Commission staff had began negotiations with Aberdeen Finance Corporation trying to liquidate our 35 shares of stock. We made a tentative offer to Aberdeen Finance Corporation for them to pay us $1,000 for each share, a total of $35,000, $1,000 per share. This resolution more or less turns us down.
Can you take a look a little below? Isn't what this resolution does is it asks us to give them until June 1st to consider and figure out what their finances are and whether they could respond favorably?
Yes, that is correct. Essentially, the last resolution asked for another six months before we do anything, and that 6 months would end about June 1st, 2007.
And then let's look at the next page of the exhibit, the letter dated January 10th, 2007. Would you explain what that is?
This is a letter from staff to Aberdeen Finance Corporation acknowledging the resolution and that we agreed not to transfer the stock to give them more time until June 1st.
And then let's look at the last four pages of the exhibit. Is that a document you recognize?
Yes, the last four pages of this exhibit, the first of which is a letter from Aberdeen Finance Corporation making a, what I would call a counteroffer, to purchase the 35 shares for $3,500. That's $100 per share. And they would make an advance payment to us for the $2,500 owed over the next 4 years. Essentially, they would pay us the $2,500 upon acceptance of this offer instead of waiting for the next 4 years.
And what are the next three pages?
The next two pages are the financial statements, a balance sheet, and an income statement of Aberdeen Finance Corporation. And the very last sheet is some additional information regarding the loans that Aberdeen Finance Corporation makes, a number of loans, collections, various things like that.
Are you aware, are these financial statements, are these audited financial statements?
I have no indication that they are audited.
But you don't actually know whether they are or not.
I do not know, but I do not see any note at the bottom that indicates that they would be audited financial statements, nor are there any notes or any auditor's letter.
Just calling your attention to one other fact here. On page one, the letter indicates, does it not, that the offer that we had made, namely the $1,000 share offer, was in fact this wasn't management. This offer was vetted at the annual stockholders meeting, and it was the shareholders of Aberdeen Finance that rejected that offer, and a counter motion was made.
That is correct.
Thank you. Take a look then now, Keith, at Exhibit 394. I would move admission first of 383.
383.
Or 393, excuse me.
Okay, Exhibit 393 has been admitted.
This higher math is tough for me, being a lawyer. Let's take a look now at 394. Do you recognize this document?
Yes, I do.
And what is it?
It is a motion for order of a determining claim and claim amounts for the proceeds.
Was this document served upon all known claimants to the S&S proceeds?
Yes, it was. It was mailed to all known claimants that submitted claims to us.
And when did that occur?
March 20th, 2007.
Did we receive return mails from some of the claimants?
Yes, we had some addresses that were incorrect. People had moved. We received numerous pieces of mail that were returned. We did additional work to find those new addresses and remail that out to new addresses in attempt to find all of the people.
And did we continue that process until we no longer received any return mails?
That is correct.
Calling your attention now to some spreadsheets that are at the back of this document, or about halfway in the middle, I guess. Could you describe for the commission what those are?
Exhibit A is the list of claimants that staff recommended denial for. Exhibit B is the list of claimants who had filed multiple claims, meaning they had two or more claims for the same contract, S&S contract. Exhibit C was staff's recommendation for claimants to be allowed to actually to receive part of the bond proceeds.
I notice that heading Exhibit B is chopped off of mine, but I believe that's what it is in the copying process.
Yeah, mine says Exhibit B consolidated.
Okay. And then let's turn to the next page, and if you could just briefly describe what that is.
The next page is what we would consider Exhibit D. That was an individual sheet that was sent to all the claimants that contained the personal information for each contract, whether it be denied, whether it be allowed, or whether it be consolidated. The one that we have here does not have any specific information. The information from Exhibit A, B, and C was actually merged onto this sheet provided to the claimant so they could see all of their individual information.
And when you say merged, that means that the information that appeared on each one of these individual pages called Exhibit D was precisely the same information for these identified fields that is on the spreadsheets.
That is correct. All the information from claimant one on Exhibit A, B, or C would match the information onto here.
And can you explain why we did that?
We did that for simplicity's sake, so the customers could see their individual information, because it was hard to get their information from Exhibit A, B, or C because of the wealth of information there. This provided their own personal sheet and personal information.
Thank you. The next page, what is that?
The next page is a blank notice of dispute and request for hearing that we sent to all the claimants in case they were disputing staff's recommendation. One of their remedies was to complete this notice of dispute and request for hearing and send it back to us.
And then the next two pages, just briefly.
The next two pages is what I would consider the top letter that was sent to everybody, explaining the whole situation, explaining the process, giving the time and date of this hearing on when they could come and meet before the commission and discuss any of their issues they had.
And the last page is what?
The last page is the order and notice of hearing for the hearing that we are here today on.
Thank you. Staff would move for the admission of staff 394.
Exhibit 394 has been admitted.
With respect to the Exhibit A, that's the denials. If you can you describe for the commission what the grounds were, the reasons we stated for denying claims that are on that list?
The first, I'm going to start from the bottom up because it's probably easier to indicate that way. SNS had what we considered investors, where people actually invested in SNS, where they gave money to SNS Communications, and they actually received what we consider a letter saying you're going to receive so much money back at an interest rate. We consider those investors. Investment amounts we did not consider to be covered under the bonds or any of the sureties. So they were put in the denied category. Second reason for denial was wireless service. SNS Communications also offered a wireless service prior to them ever getting into the landline phone service. These claims are for wireless service contracts. Another reason for denial was out of state. We had a number of claimants from Iowa, North Dakota, Montana, Nebraska, even California, Minnesota, that actually that submitted claims for our bond. We it's staff's recommendation that those be denied because they are not a South Dakota customer under the jurisdiction of this commission and not covered under the bond. Another reason for denial was amount paid was fully realized. Let me explain that. A number of SNS's customers could not afford to pay the $3,000, the $5,000, the $10,000 up front or whatever the contract amount may be. So they went through different financing different financing entities to actually finance that, where the financing entity actually paid SNS Communications some amount, and the customer then made monthly payments usually to these customer to the entity. Upon SNS's when SNS quit providing service, many of these customers actually quit paying, and after several litigation and communications with staff and everything, many of these financial institutions decided that they couldn't collect on those loans anymore because some of them were more in a lease contract and for various other reasons. So they quit paying on there. And then the amount of – so we consider that the amount of the loan forgiven. Well, the amount of loan forgiven, the principal amount of the loan forgiven actually exceeded the amount of service left on the contract. So therefore – those customers actually received all of the service that they paid for. Another one that we had is the contract term had actually expired, where they submitted a claim. They were still getting service. The contract had expired, and when SNS quit providing service, they lost their service, but they should have discontinued getting service months before that because their contract with SNS had actually expired.
You may have mentioned this. Did this category also include claims where the amount or to the extent they were covered by insurance and they received insurance proceeds?
Well, actually, we didn't have any of those identified on this exhibit.
Okay.
Our later exhibit, we do.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go to those later exhibits. Let me ask you this. Since we sent out that notice on March 20th and, subsequent notices to return mails, et cetera, have we heard from claimants regarding errors or disagreements with our recommendations as noted on those three exhibits?
Yes, we have.
And how have these been handled?
For the most part, if customers would call that they needed a name change, for example, many times their business manager would have filled out the claim form. They changed the name. Sometimes we actually got notice from the claimant themselves that they actually received the piece of mail, but their address had changed. They would call us, we'd discuss it, and we'd simply make that change. On the ones where there was actually numbers that changed, where it would change the claim amount that they had, we actually went back through their records to see what they had provided, and at times we found, you know, typos, or we were reading the contract a little bit different than they were, and if they identified those, and if staff looked at them, and if we agreed with them, we made the change right into the exhibit.
Thank you. Let's now turn to exhibits 395 and 396. Those are the larger spreadsheet documents.
I have them.
Who is that? Is that me or you or? I don't think I actually did anything, but
that's a constant.
Okay. Okay, Keith, I don't know if I...
I'm sorry to interject. Do we know what's causing that and so that we can get it fixed?
That's a constant.
But that's always
that's
the case.
That's always on.
Are we okay now to go?
I'm ready.
Is your mic on?
I think it's on, yep.
Okay. Let's now turn again, Keith, take a look at exhibits 395 and 396. That's the large spreadsheets.
I have them.
Would you please describe what those are, what they're entitled, and what they are in relation to what we've been talking about here?
I'll start with Exhibit 396, if I may. 396 is entitled Exhibit E, Confidential Version. And what this exhibit lists is all our corrected information from the previous Exhibits A, B, and C, which we just discussed in Staff Exhibit 394. This is all the corrected information as staff sees it. That is a confidential version. Exhibit 395 is the exact same information with several columns. The business name, the claimant's first name and last name, and, with those three columns removed for confidential reasons, and that's a non-confidential version. But essentially all the information on Exhibit 395 and 396 are identical.
And the only reason we deleted that information is we elected not to parade all these people's personal information out in public.
That is correct.
I don't know that it makes any difference which document we look at, so I'm going to refer to them interchangeably.
Ms. Weiss, is it appropriate for me to ask a clarifying question about what we're looking at with the exhibit? So... Exhibit E, non-confidential version, contains the exact same information as we were looking at with Exhibits A, B, C, and D, only it's organized numerically by claim?
No, that is not correct. Exhibit E, whether you look at the confidential version or the non-confidential version, is all of the information from A, B, and C, but it has been corrected for all the claimants that called and corrected their information. Exhibit 395 and 396, which are both Exhibit E, confidential version and non-confidential version, are identically the same.
Okay. And one more question, if I might. I'm hearing examiner. Is this current as of today? Any complaints we've had from people calling in has been updated in the spreadsheet?
Yes, that is correct. And thanks. I think John will be getting into that in a little bit.
Great. My apologies for jumping the gun. Thanks,
Ryan. And a note on that, and we were going to get into this, but can you just explain why we didn't go back and call them A, B, and C again?
For simplicity's sake, because if the commission approves this, we didn't want them referring to Exhibit A, B, and C being approved, and getting confused which was the correct one, so we called it Exhibit E. Just gave it a new exhibit number for simplicity's sake.
We did segment the information as we did in the first three exhibits into the three categories of data.
Yes, if you will look, we changed it around a little bit. The first three pages are what staff would consider the allowed claims. The fourth page lists all the consolidated claims. And the fifth page lists all the what staff would consider denied claims.
Okay, Keith, just not without wasting too much time on it, but now I want to turn to the substance of what these documents show. And if we could, and again, I think with respect to maybe quickly, consolidated, the reason for that is always the same, is it not?
Pardon me, I didn't understand that.
With respect to the consolidated claims, the reason for consolidation, our recommendation of consolidation, is always the same.
Correct.
And what is that reason?
The reason is because at one point the commission determined that all complaints against S&S would be considered claims against the bond. So at one point in time we had people who submitted a complaint against S&S that was given a CT03 docket number, and then also they submitted a bond claim form. So we had duplicates. At times we had people just submitting them to us willy-nilly. When we sent out our second notice, we had people sending second, third. Sometimes we have four. I think in one case we have four claims against the bond for the exact same contract.
With respect to consolidated claims, in your consideration of the claim into which the other claims were consolidated, have you considered any supplemental information that may have been provided in those subsequently filed claims in making your decision?
I believe the answer is no, unless I misunderstand your question.
I think you're misunderstanding
okay.
it. When we talk about consolidation, if we received in a subsequent bond claim filing, in a subsequent round, new information that may have changed our opinion, for example, we look at something and we see new information that shows that, in fact, they did write a check on X date and pay. Did you consider all of that when we considered the allowed claim or the one into which it was consolidated?
Yes.
So we considered all the information together in our recommendations.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying.
And let's go now to denial, and maybe just point out, I think it's really simple to see. Would you just explain where the reasoning is, where the reason columns are for the commission, please?
Yes. If you look at about two-thirds of the way to the right side of the page, right before the first double line, the column to the left of the first double line, it says reason for denial. And there are the two, in there, we have now added those two claims that John referred to earlier as insurance recovery, which is another reason for denial.
And one last clarifying question on those particular two claims. Did we serve the March 20th notice on those two entities?
Actually, no, we didn't. After our mailing was complete and printed and we were stuffing envelopes, we realized that these two entities may have had received an insurance payment or some other sort of forgiveness. So while we were stuffing envelopes, we actually called, sent an email. We did receive confirmation back from both of these entities that they no longer had claims against the bond. So instead of redoing our previous exhibit A, B, C, and D, we just did not mail it to them and didn't change the information. But then we added them in. We moved them from the accepted to the denial category at their request.
And I guess we don't want to identify. Do we want to identify those two claims by number? Is that important to the commission?
I could identify. I prefer not to use the names, but it would be claim 16 and 46.
And did we receive an email from the chief financial officer of those two companies who is the same person telling us, requesting that those claims be dismissed?
Yes, we have an email placed in the other exhibit, the individual claim file of this, Same financial officer for both companies requesting that or indicating they no longer had a claim.
Thank you. Before I turn to the allows, which I think is the meat of the matter here, let's turn a minute just to let's consider the claims themselves. And this one's kind of an awkward exhibit here. In there are 300 and in two boxes that are sitting up with the commissioners are 384 files marked as exhibits, as staff exhibits 1 through 384. Would you please explain for the commission to the commission what those files are?
Those files contain all of the information that the commission has received, whether it be a complaint against SNS or whether it be a bond claim form, and the relevant information that was received from it. I also need to note that the exhibit number on each one of those files matches the claim number on Exhibit E, and also with Exhibit A, B, and C, but those are no longer relevant.
And have we spent the last 2 months or so scouring through all that stuff to make sure that everything is in those files?
I actually, I'd have to say we probably spent the last 2.5 years going through those. But, yes, they were entered in probably anywhere between a year and a half to 2 years ago. All the information was entered in. In the last 2 months, we have been going through each file, making sure the information is correct on our own and from contacts we have with individuals, claimants.
I'm going to offer staff exhibits 1 through 384.
Exhibits 1 through 384 are admitted.
Thank you. Okay, now, Keith, let's go to the spreadsheet labeled allowed claims.
Exhibit E?
Exhibit E, pardon me. And that's either Exhibit 395 or 396, doesn't matter. Would you please walk the commission from left to right across the top of the page, the category descriptions, and please describe for them what each of these columns is and what type of computations lead one to the number results that we see in successive columns to the right?
Starting at the leftmost column, claim number is specifically the number that staff assigned as a claim. The second column, titled docket number or bond claim batch, I call it a reference number for us. It either has a CT03 number representing the docket number for the complaint, or else it has the words first or second, which helps us denote when the bond claim was received. Those would all be bond claim forms. It would either be received under the first batch or the second batch. The third column is the business name, and I'm going off of Exhibit 396. Is the business name. That information was taken from the information, either the bond claim form or from the complaint. The next column, first name, is just the claimant's first name. The last name is the claimant's last name. The next column would be city. That's essentially the city that the individual, the mailing address, or the city of the mailing address for the individual. The next column, ST, denotes the state in which they currently live in. The next column, entitled total contract amount, that amount was taken from the information received, and it denotes the total contract amount that the individual claimant had with SNS Communications. The next column, entitled contract term years, is the term of the contract in years. The next column, entitled date contract signed, is merely the date that the claimant signed the contract with SNS. The next column percent of contract remaining is simply a calculation of how much of the term is remaining on the contract as of June 3rd, 2003, the date that SNS Communications quit providing service. It's simply a division calculation. The next column, entitled Contract Remaining Value, is simply the percent of contract remaining times the total contract amount, which gives us how much essentially service, a dollar amount of the service that is left on the contract after SNS quit providing service. The next column, titled Amount Financed and Forgiven or Insured, is a number of, contains a number of different information. Most of them are actually zeros, but as I indicated earlier, some of the claimants actually financed their contract payments, and that's the amount that the finance company actually forgave, or it indicates the amount that the claimants received in insurance or some other type of settlement with third parties. The next column is recommended claim amount, and in parentheses I put staff calculated. That is a staff calculated number, which essentially takes the contract remaining value plus the amount financed and forgiven or insured to come up with the recommended claim amount, the amount that we believe that they had a valid claim for on the proceeds. The next column is staff's recommended disposition. We kind of discussed that earlier, whether it be allowed, consolidated, or denied. The next column, titled Reason for Denial, on all the allowed claims, that would read not applicable because the claim was allowed. But in the other ones, whether it be consolidated or denied, we just give a brief explanation of why we consolidated or denied them. The next three columns are a calculation under the straight line allocation method. The first of those three columns, titled straight line claim fraction, is a calculated amount that we calculated, which represents the amount of the claim fraction that each individual would receive. When you add the total of the straight line claim fraction, it should equal one. Now, because of rounding, when you get to the very last page of the allowed, when you carry it out to about the 6th, 7th decimal, we do have it doesn't quite equal one, but it's, you know, we're talking fractions of a penny there. The next line is the estimated straight line distribution. What that amount is the claim fraction multiplied times $180,000. The $180,000 is the sum of the $275,000 bonds we received and the $30,000 bond. That $80,000 is an amount that's subject to change. It's just kind of a placeholder. And that the only reason why we list that is to give the individuals an estimated amount that they would receive and to provide some information to the commission. We're not asking the commission to approve that column. We're looking at the claim fraction as the important number, because once we have the claim fraction, it doesn't matter if we have $1 of proceeds or $200,000 of proceeds. We can calculate how much each individual would get. The third column under the straight line allocation section is a distribution of the 35 shares. That number there represents the number of shares that each claimant would receive if the commission decided to distribute the shares. Essentially what we did is we took the claim fraction times 35, and it gives you the estimated distribution of shares. The next four columns represent what we call a weighted allocation. This is a somewhat different calculation than the straight line. The straight line purely calculates it based on time. The weighted allocation actually gives some credence to the argument that those customers who came in, became customers in SNS at the end, were hurt the most because of the service they received was a cheap service. So if you received a year, 2 years, 3 years of your contract, you may have actually received benefit than had you used a different long-distance carrier. So what we did is we weighted them to provide a higher distribution to those individuals who came in at the end. And let me go through those four individual columns. The first column is the weighted contract claim amount. What that amount is I took the recommended claim amount from previous columns times the percent of contract remaining. That essentially lowered everybody's claim amount, but those people who had 90% of their service left to receive, it only lowered it by 10%. Someone who received 90% of their service, only had 10% of their service left, it lowered their claim by 90%. Therefore, reducing the claim amount on an inverse relationship of the amount of time that was left in their contract, essentially giving those who came in last bigger credit for their contract amount, those that came in way early in the situation, a smaller fraction of the claim. Then I took the total of the weighted contract amount and I divided it by I took the individual's weighted contract amount, divided it by the total weighted contract amount to come up with a weighted claim fraction, which you see in the next column. The column following that is estimated weighted distribution based on the $180,000. Again, that just took the weighted claim fraction It took the weighted claim fraction times the $180,000. Again, the $180,000 is just an estimate. And then the last column on that spreadsheet is the estimated distribution of the 35 shares based on the weighted allocation. Again, it's just the weighted claim fraction times the 35 shares.
Thank you. I'd like to now call your attention to Exhibits 397, Staff 397, and Staff 398. I think those are stapled together, Ms. Wiest, in the ones that we have by the admin people downstairs. They got stapled together, but I think they're both there. Do you have those, Keith?
Yes, I do.
Would you please describe what these are for the commission and go through them?
Exhibit Staff 397 is a summary of all the substantive changes that were made as a result of the mailing, the notice to customers that we sent out on March 20th of 2007. This summarizes all the changes from Exhibit A, B, and C, the changes that we made to Exhibit A, B, and C, which resulted in our new Exhibit E. Should I go through each individual claim?
I think they're self-explanatory. The two on the top denoted Claim 16 and Claim 46. Those are the two that we've already discussed. Is that correct?
Yes, the first and the third claims on there were already discussed. They were the company who called in said they no longer have a claim.
The primary reason for the changes really was mistakes that we made in in-state and out-of-state determinations.
Yeah, in-state, out-of-state determinations, typos on a date. One of them, we were reading the contract a little bit different. We came up with a different contract amount than they did.
And all of these have been incorporated in Exhibit E, whether the confidential or non-confidential version.
That is correct.
Okay, let's take a look at 398. Please explain what that is.
398 is a summary of the written disputes that we received back from the customers from our March 20, 2007 mailing. Essentially, we received two claimants who submitted a written dispute based on that stock form that we sent them. Should I go through each those two?
If the commissioners are interested, I mean, it puts it in writing. These were disputes, so I think they might want to at least have an explanation of what happened here.
The last of the two claims disputes on there, claim 356, was the first one that we received. Originally, we had and still have this claim listed as denied because it was a wireless service contract. The claimant submitted the notice of dispute and request for hearing. I received that. I called the individual, talked to him. Their big concern was, why does a wireless service preclude me from making a claim on the bond? I explained to him the jurisdictional issues, that these bonds were issued for landline service, landline long-distance service. He began to understand. I made it clear to him that he still could come to the commission and actually have a hearing, present his case. But when I indicated to him that if the commission did accept his dispute and actually paid him for the wireless, the amount of money that he received wasn't worth his time to sit on the phone or to actually come to peer. So he indicated to me that he would not be calling in and that he would not come to the commission meeting. Claim 59 is a little bit more complicated. We originally had this as an accepted claim. It still is an accepted claim. The individual who submitted this dispute indicated that they may have a possible future claim against the bond related to some third-party litigation. We had numerous discussions with the claimant on this, and in the end, the claimant sent me an email on May 7th indicating that he wanted his dispute withdrawn.
Thank you. Staff would offer staff's exhibits 395, 396, 397, and 398.
Those four exhibits are admitted.
Keith, could you take a look at exhibit 399? I was supposed to take that a while ago. It's real simple. I just wanted it.
I have it.
Okay. Can you describe what that is? Let me just ask. I'll ask you a leading question. Is that the notice that we mailed out back in 2005 in August, and then follow up in September and October of 2005?
Yes, this is the notice that we mailed to all individuals that we believe that were customers of S&S that had not already either filed a claim against the bond or a complaint against S&S.
And we got those names from?
Most of those names were received from a list that S&S provided us after they quit providing service that they said was a complete list of all their customers.
Did we also look at information that had been provided from financing companies that we had reason to believe would have been involved in this?
Yes, that is correct. We knew of three financing institutions that were actually financing S&S contracts, and we either subpoenaed or they voluntarily gave us all the information for all customers that they had loans with that had a South Dakota address.
Is it your opinion that we did everything that could reasonably be expected to give notice to former S&S customers of their right to file a claim?
Yes, we made direct mailings, and we also posted notices in numerous statewide newspapers.
Now I'd like to call your attention to Staff Exhibit 403.
I have that.
Is that familiar to you?
Yes, it is.
Would you please describe for the commission what that is?
This is a letter and an order from the commission that was sent out to all the claimants that were listed on previous exhibits, whether they be accepted, denied, or consolidated claimants. It was mailed to all the claimants that we knew of that indicated that at this hearing we would also be taking up the issue of what to do with the Aberdeen Finance Corporation stock, or shall I say the offer that was made to us. And it lets them know that they can either appear at the hearing or be here by telephone, or participate by telephone, excuse me.
Did you receive any calls or other communications from claimants relative to that notice?
It's hard. I did receive phone calls following the mailing of this. It's hard to tell whether it was related specifically to this, but I do not recall anyone that contacted me regarding, excuse me, there were.
Is there somebody that might operate an elevator that might have called you?
Yes, we actually had two people call in. Thank you, John. We had two people call in that expressed their belief regarding the what we should do with the Aberdeen Finance Corporation stock.
And what was that expression?
Take the money and distribute it from both of the individuals who called in.
And is the reason you're not identifying them by name because we've had a policy here of not doing that?
Yes, I could dig through my files and get you the actual claimant number if you would prefer. I don't have that right in front of me. I've got it in my file here. I could dig on my personal notes.
Backing up again to Exhibits 395, 396, that's Exhibit E. And again, the purpose of the E is because that follows D, which is the last exhibit that we had in our mailing. But the weighted versus straight line claim fractions, you've listed those both in a neutral fashion. Do you have a recommendation on behalf of staff as to which of those methods the commission ought to approve today?
It's my belief that the commission should approve the straight line allocation method.
Do you have a set of reasons for that?
Mostly because it's the most straightforward, it's the clearest, it's the simplest method of calculating, and also it treats all customers exactly the same. It doesn't take into any consideration of when the contract was signed or whatever. It just simply calculates it based on the amount of time they had left on their contract.
In addition to the notice that we provided and setting the business of the stock on for hearing today in addition to the claims themselves, did the commission request us to do anything else at the April 24th meeting involving the stock?
Yes. The commission ordered staff to seek out a professional view of what the 35 shares let me correct myself there. They directed us to seek out professional individuals who could help us decide whether or not the offer provided to us from Aberdeen Finance Corporation was an offer that the commission should accept or reject or make other recommendations.
And what steps did you take and other members of staff to do that?
We contacted various individuals, whether it be attorneys or whatever, and started compiling a list of names of consultants who would possibly do this. We contacted two ourselves, and we also had a third consultant actually contact us. We did not seek them out. He sought us out.
You said we contacted, how many did we contact? Three?
I want to say two.
Okay.
One second, let me.
That might be.
For those listening on the internet, we'll just note that we haven't had an interruption in the sound, but we're just allowing the witness to gather some information.
We contacted two, and we had a third contact us, is what my notes indicate.
Okay. Thank you. Are you aware of whether there was a complicating reason why we could not contact additional persons that had been recommended to us by various people? You may not know because some of those conversations were between me and...
Yeah.
Are you aware at all of the conflict of interest problems that occurred as a result of the particular accounting firm that...
Okay.
Aberdeen Finance happens to use and the company that they are now about to merge with.
Yes, we did. I didn't include them in my notes because I didn't see them as a viable contact, but we did contact a third entity, and it just so happened that the individual we contacted worked for the CPA firm, who was also the entity that represented Aberdeen Finance Corporation in the bankruptcy, and I think was their current is still their current accountant. So we did contact three.
Thank you. In addition, are you aware of whether or not we also had conversations with the securities division involving this situation?
Yes. We had some email communications and phone conversations.
And did you provide the plan of reorganization and other documents relevant to this issue, the offer letters, et cetera, to the people over at Division of Insurance?
Yes, I did.
And those financial statements that were attached?
Yes, I did.
Thank you. Calling your attention now to Exhibits Staff 401 and 402.
I have them.
Could you please describe what these exhibits are for the commission?
Exhibit 401 is a letter addressed to gentlemen, John and myself, and it is information that a consultant provided us in regard to his evaluation of the Aberdeen Finance Corporation offer that we received based on the financial statements, the bankruptcy plan, and other information that staff was able to provide him. That's Exhibit 401. Exhibit 402 is a letter we received from a second consultant who did essentially the same thing, reviewed the financial information that we had from Aberdeen Finance Corporation, the offer, the bankruptcy plan, and maybe some other information that staff had actually provided to them in an email.
I'm sure the commissioners can read these for themselves and draw their own conclusions, but would you want to take just a few minutes to sort of characterize these two exhibits and the divergence of opinion that seems to be expressed in them?
Well, it seems kind of shocking how two different consultants looking at the exact same information can come up with two very different opinions. Staff Exhibit 401, I would say, is probably the more detailed of the two, where the consultant actually went into the financial information, drew up some conclusions, made some adjustments to the financial statements. Clearly, this person has had banking background, is familiar with GAAP accounting, and essentially, if I could summarize his conclusion, is that it appears that the $100 an offer made is probably one that the commission should accept. But again, that's based on the information that he had given to him. The Exhibit 402 I would say doesn't go into quite the detail on the financial statements, but gives kind of the opposite opinion and indicates that the $100 an offer we received is probably one that we should not accept.
Did he express an opinion concerning the number we've thrown out before, which I think it was a little bit incorrect, that number you used it on the 24th, the book value number?
Yeah, the book value of the shares is $1,250. He did indicate that an offer about that amount, maybe discounted slightly, would probably be something that the commission should look at and accept, and actually referenced at times, maybe $1,000 per share would be a better amount for the commission to accept.
And did that consultant offer at least one alternative other than those that we had identified in our mailing?
Yeah, he offered to get out his checkbook and pay $150 a share today for him.
In his list of alternatives, he also proposed one other possibility, did he not? His list of options.
Oh, well, we could. He actually made four recommendations. We could keep the shares for a few more years. We could actually sell them at auction, or we could distribute the 35 shares to the 250 plus parties.
And what about option one? Isn't that a little different than options that we had looked at?
Yeah, I mean, that option, that option is essentially to share them at book value with the payments over a 60-month period at a 7% annual interest rate. If you discount that you would come up with about $1,000 per share. I was probably summarizing that if they could pay for them all today. But he was simply saying, sell them back at book value, $1,250, and charge 7% interest and collect that over 60 months.
Thank you. Again, that's all the exhibits I have for you. With respect to back on exhibit E again, do you have a recommendation to offer to the commission? You've given yours on the straight line versus weighted methods. Beyond that, what would your recommendation be to the commission today?
My recommendation would be to, as far as Exhibit E is concerned, is to deny all the claims that we have listed under the denied category. I would recommend that the commission make a motion and approve consolidation of all the claims that are listed under the consolidated claims. And I would recommend that the commission approve all the allowed claims and approve the recommended claim amount and use the straight line allocation claim fraction and approve the straight line claim fraction allocation method.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Smith, I don't have 399, 403, 401, or 402 offered yet.
Pardon me. Which one is it now? 399?
399, 403, 401, and 402.
Okay. 401 and 402. Well, I would offer those now.
Okay. Exhibits 399, 403, 401, 402 are offered and admitted.
Had I had 403 admitted?
No, I just didn't.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Tendering Keith for commissioner questions.
On Exhibit 385, it refers to a collateral agreement, and then you referred to it, I believe, as a non-recourse agreement. Could you give us some more information on what that means? And if it is, and if I'm trying to get information that's really not important for this proceeding, I mean, feel free to tell me that, too. I still want kind of an answer, but you don't have to dive into a bunch of depth if it's unnecessary.
First of all, what I refer to as a collateral agreement or the recourse agreement is the same thing. The order refers to it as a collateral agreement. It has become known, the staff refers to it lately as the non-recourse agreement. What that is, when S&S Communication first started providing service, it was prior to the commission even knowing that they were providing service or giving them a certificate of authority. So when they came in and asked for a certificate of authority, they had a large number of customers already, and they had accepted a large number of prepayments already. During the process of trying to get some sort of coverage, staff said, and at that point, I think that amount was somewhere in the neighborhood of, according to what S&S information they gave us at that time, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000 to $800,000 worth of prepayments that they had already collected and that they needed to, service that they yet needed to provide. So I indicated to them I need a $800,000 bond. They indicated there's no way that they could get an $800,000 bond. I told them, I said, well, see if you can get some other sort of surety toward us. They came back, and at that time, predominantly they were using Aberdeen Finance Corporation for the company who was financing the S&S loans. At that point, we believe that number was somewhere in their neighborhood of about $600,000 to $700,000. Of the $800,000 that they were giving, most of that was actually loaned out. What they offered to us was Aberdeen Finance Corporation agreed that if SNS Communications should quit providing service, they would cease collections on those loans to SNS customers. The difference between the total amount that that SNS Communications told us was prepaid amounts and the recourse agreement was supposed to be covered in bonds. So originally, if the total unearned revenue by SNS at that time was $800,000, then Aberdeen Finance Corporation said that they had $750,000 worth of loans sitting out there, so the bond calculation would have been $50,000. Now, those numbers are not exact. I'm just giving some estimates.
Thank you. Exhibit 385, the Certificate of Authority, notes that SNS should be required to maintain a $50,000 surety bond as well as additional bonding to provide 100% coverage of the prepaid amounts. Do they maintain that level of bonding?
We believed they did based on the information they provided us. At the end, they also had to provide reports, yearly reports to determine their bond calculations. After about their third or fourth report, we started noticing inconsistencies, names were disappearing, I just told them, I said, I don't believe you guys are providing all the information. So they provided us with some supplemental information. At that time, it was clear that they were underbonded because their reports were less than accurate.
Thank you. You noted investors and the fact that staff has recommended denial for all claims of those that you decided to categorize as investors. We didn't receive any disputes from any investors, any informally or formally?
I did not take any phone calls from any investors. I did not receive any formal written disputes. Prior to our March 20, 2007 notice, we have had discussions with numerous investors, one of which, who didn't even submit a claim to us, actually had a complaint issued before the commission and had that complaint actually withdrawn. But we have had discussion with a number of those investors, but not in response to recent action of the commission. We have not heard anything.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I did have a conversation with at least one investor. It just so happened that I'm the one who got that call.
Okay.
He did not, for whatever reason, elect to either file a notice of dispute. They are, several of them, I will add, too, are represented by attorneys. So, and they've been served. The attorneys were served with all of this. Greg Rediger over at Miller, he represents a number of them.
Okay. I'm moving now to Exhibit A. And I'll pause for just a moment so Mr. Sanger can get resituated. And because we now have Exhibit E, I'm not sure that this matters, but on Exhibit A...
Can you give me a staff exhibit number?
Yes. They were part of Exhibit 394.
Thank you.
Which was the first half was a staff motion, and the second half was the spreadsheets.
I have it.
Exhibit A, there is a line underneath claim number 332, and the fields are all vacant except for the fifth and sixth from the right. And I just want to verify that that's not we're not missing information there, and that was.
No, as you can see, the line entitled Claim 332 has all the information. Then there's kind of almost a blank line, and then the next claim is 333. Essentially, that was just a cut-and-paste error that I had. I just copied, denied an amount claim into there and didn't into a blank line.
Okay, thanks. I'm still in Exhibit 394, and there appear to be a few instances where there are fields highlighted, and specifically claim numbers 1, 59, and 312. And I think because I've read the staff motion, I understand why two of the three highlighted are that. I mean, there was some confusion as to what the effective date was for a couple of those large customers.
Could you give me those claim numbers one more time?
Sure. 1, 59, and 312. I understand two of the three, but I don't understand the third. So I was hoping to, if the highlighting is important, I was hoping to get your some information on it.
I'm fumbling because, to me, the claim number doesn't mean a whole lot. The name behind the claim number means more, so I'm going into Exhibit E to find out who the claimant was.
Perhaps I can narrow it down for you a little bit, Mr. Singer. Claim number 312.
It
is a claim that is not mentioned specifically in the staff motion as claims 1 and 59 were. 312 is highlighted in Exhibit
2B,
but is not highlighted in E. Is that of any importance?
I do not believe 312 is. I would have to go into, as claim 312 is a consolidated claim because it's a duplicate with CT03064. And if I go into 064, which is not an easy cross-reference, excuse me, on claim 312, I believe the highlighted on Exhibit B was probably a note to myself of some point to go back and check that one. When I have in front of me Exhibit 312, and that contract sign date, the column that is highlighted, agrees to the contract sign date that is listed on the proof of claim. So I believe that may have just been a previous note to myself that I never unhighlighted it. That column is correct.
Okay.
And the other one was 159.
The others, I believe that the are both addressed. There were some date issues that were addressed in the motion for order determining claims and claim amounts and establishing claim fractions. So it was mostly 312 I was concerned about. I have a bunch of other questions. Maybe I'll ask two more and then let my colleagues hop in here too. You noted that you had two. I'll back up. Commission staff sent out to every claimant information on the decision that was facing the commission with regard to the AFC stock. Correct?
That is correct.
Following that letter, you received only two opinions from claimants regarding what this commission should do with that AFC stock.
Yes.
Both opinions were that the commission should sell the stock at the offer price of $100 a share and then distribute the proceeds. Is that right?
Yes, but that offer also included accept the $2,500 up front instead of waiting for the 4 years. But, yes, that was the opinion of both the individuals who called.
Did those that it's in the last 24 hours we've received the two consultants' letters of advice. Is that right?
That's correct.
So would in speaking with the investors, did you get any feel for their level of sophistication? I mean, trying to ask this question in a way that's legally acceptable, but in the conversation, did the claimants that you spoke to give any indication that they understood how far below book value $100 a share was?
Both. One of the individuals in particular was a manager of an elevator who appeared to have a very sound knowledge for financing. And he clearly knew, in my opinion, the situation that we were in, and that the $100 an offer was far less than anything else that we had offered prior to. It was below book value. I believe that he understood that. As far as the other one, I'd have to look back to my notes to refresh my memory of who that individual was. I can't recall it off the top of my head.
In the letter, the advice letter from Kettle Thorstenson, I believe suggestion number 3 was to sell at an auction. Do you have any idea whether or not technically that option is available to the commission?
I was involved in conversations between, and some of them secondhand, between John Smith and Gail Shepik. It is my understanding that there is we may possibly be precluded from doing that because of some security laws that I can't speak to at all. But it may not be legally possible for us to put them out on eBay and ask people to bid on them.
Mr. Smith, will you have anyone providing any information as to whether or not the option is available to the commission?
We could have Mr. Shepik is here at my request, and we could certainly see if he'd be willing to step up to the mic and speak about it. You know, we just got this yesterday, and I've been scrambling like a madman just to get ready today. If I had some time, yeah, I could dig into it and give you a definitive answer. You know, I don't know, because we're going to have to wait for at least, I'm going to say a minimum of 5 weeks after decision for the appeal time to run. I mean, if the commission doesn't want to bolt to a conclusion on this issue, I would say don't do it. And we'll take a little more time and do that kind of research.
At this time, we'll set aside any other questions I've got until later.
My only question would be, does the court reporter need a break? I believe so. Can we just take a 10 minute? Okay, thanks. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes. At this time, are there any further questions from any of the commissioners?
I just have one question for you. If you look at Exhibit E, I don't think it matters which version. I just have questions on number 100. Let me get my... Yeah, 100, 157, and then 340, 351, 352. They have out-of-state addresses. Could you explain why they did not get admitted?
I can either take those individually or address them as a group.
As a group is fine. I'm sure they have the same answer.
Well, I think they may change a little bit. I know specifically Claim 100 is a dual state business.
Okay.
They have locations in North Dakota and South Dakota. We took only a portion of the claim that it applies to South Dakota. If you will look for Claim 100, I'm sure there is another claim down in the denied that we actually separated it. And we could go down there and look. Based on the business name, you will see that same business name
sure.
as being part of it being denied. Okay. I can go through all the rest of them if you would like.
No, that was...
Yeah.
That's basically the premise, is if they have a business location.
Yeah, there are a few that claimants who actually lived in South Dakota, took service when they were in South Dakota, had service from SNS. When SNS discontinued service, they were still in South Dakota. But after SNS quit providing service, the individual or the business may have moved to a foreign state. We still consider them a South Dakota claimant because the business was in South Dakota, and just because they moved doesn't remove them, because it's at the time when this took place is what we considered. I'm sure a few of those are that, but I can't think of any other reason off the top of my head without going through everyone why in that case a North Dakota or a foreign state would receive a payment.
Okay, thank you.
Keith,
I might note on that, if I might, that several of those where we changed, if you look at the change exhibit, which is I think is 387, those were precisely that. We had a Nebraska address, a Minneapolis address, and various other addresses. One was a Montana address. Initially, we believed they were out of state, and when we dug into it, we realized that in fact, they were located here relative to the SNS service and had moved after the fact.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Keith, I'd like to ask you some questions pertaining to the summaries and valuations, and maybe my questions are premature, and I don't suspect that you know the answers to these, but I'm just on the off chance that you do. The questions will all be on the equity statement and the income statement, asset and liabilities. First of all, jump away from that and just ask, do you know what our percent of the ownership is? I shouldn't say ours, but the 35 shares. Any idea what the percent of that?
Roughly 2.5%. You take 35 divided by 1,442. That roughly equates to 2.5%.
I should know the number of shares total. And I did not. 1,140, you say?
1,442.
Thank you. a lot of this depends upon cash flow and dividends, things of that nature, whether it makes sense to hold on to these or not. Do you know historically have they paid dividends?
I do not know anything prior to the bankruptcy, anything about Aberdeen Finance Corporation, their financial situation. What I can tell you about dividends is I believe the bankruptcy plan and the covenants that Aberdeen Finance Corporation has with Wells Fargo prevents them from paying any dividends until Wells Fargo is paid in full regarding AFC's debt to Wells Fargo. The debt covenants cover that.
Are there any other holders of debt that that applies to other than Wells Fargo? Do they have to pay their debt to any other entity?
Well, keep in mind that a stockholder is always at the bottom of the totem pole. Whether it is where Wells Fargo holds a lien on all of AFC's assets, they, of course, have first rights to any money that Aberdeen Finance Corporation would come up. Next, and I don't know the exact order. It's been a long time since, you know, I've studied this, but I do know that even unsecured debt has a priority in front of stockholders when you're talking liquidation, whether you're talking bankruptcy or whatever. All other debts have to be paid. I know payroll fits into there on a bankruptcy. Like I said, I don't have the priority memorized, but I know that stockholders are at the bottom of the list. So indirectly answering your question, yes, all other debt has to be paid before stockholders.
Reality, of course, is as we attempt some way to figure out what the value of the stock is, that there has to be a market for it in order to, we could surmise that it's worth any amounts of money, and if there isn't a market for it, then it doesn't matter, does it? So perhaps my exercise is going to be totally unnecessary, but I still would like to examine it anyway. And I'm reminded of what I said last time and what I was reminded just a little moment ago by another party is that we're spending lots of time, lots of folks, lots of taxpayers' money on this, and in the hopes that we might make a little difference between $3,500 and $4,500. So it's a challenge from that perspective. However, when you look at the income statement and you see that the interest collected on small loans, if that's annualized, it shows $39,000 a quarter. So annualizing that is nearly $470,000 a quarter. And if you analyze the monthly amount as well, that is $476,000. So it would appear that they collect interest of approximately $470,000 a year. And it is marked interest as opposed to P&I. So that sends up a flag immediately that there's a pretty significant amount of money flowing into the company. It also shows something that I'm rather curious about. On the first page under assets, it shows a building worth $44,800. It also shows right under that building, it shows equipment. And I wouldn't imagine that you'd have any idea whether that equipment is computers or what, that personal property, or is it, I wouldn't imagine it's air conditionings and things of that nature. Do you know?
Well, no, I do not know. But what I can tell you about building and equipment, those two amounts on the balance sheet, is that if you go down to the liabilities, now keep in mind you don't record depreciation as a liability. You record it as a contra asset. So they recorded it in the wrong place. But if you go down to liabilities, you can see that that $44,000 building is just about fully depreciated. You can see that the $92,000 worth of building equipment is just about fully depreciated. Now, depreciated value, when you take the book value, or you, when you take the asset value minus the depreciation, that does not mean always, especially on something like a building, does not always mean what the building is worth on a market value if you're going to sell that.
Exactly. And that's what, that's the question. I want to get to the depreciation in a moment, but the, what I was curious about was the building and whether the equipment was office equipment. It says building equipment, but it's $100,000 worth of building equipment.
If I was to guess, and this is purely a guess, is that the equipment represents computers, air conditioning, heating system, but that is purely a guess. I do not know that. I can't think of what other equipment they would have that would total that amount.
Well, it shows furniture and fixtures of $59,000, so I was really curious what equipment they have for $92,000. On the income statement, on the other hand, it shows under income $1,400 for a month and nearly $3,300 for the quarter. If those are annualized, then they are approximately $17,000 a month.
What was that for?
Excuse me, $17,000 annually. That's for rental income. It appears what they're doing is paying themselves rent. They're renting out the building from themselves. And if that's the case, then they're paying $17,000 a year rent. That's a net, because it shows they're paying taxes and utilities, etc., in other areas under expenses.
I don't know if I would make that conclusion.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible. If they're recording the building on their balance sheet and then renting it out to themselves, if that truly is the case,
it should be expense.
They probably are not accounting for that properly. I have not even noticed that. When I look at rent income, I believe that they may have a little corner of their building that they're renting out to some other business, some other individual, or something. That's my first impression of what rent income would be, but I do not know that. I am just purely speculating based on my first guess and when I see net rent income. I do not know that.
And you're right, except that under expenses, it doesn't show any expenses for rent. So they have an asset somewhere, is what I'm getting at, and they're receiving $17,000 a year for that asset. And the only asset that I see that they could be receiving income off of is the building. And if they're using a portion of that building for their company, and in addition to that, they're receiving $17,000 in rent, then the building has to be worth at least a couple hundred thousand dollars.
It's also possible, just possible, purely guessing, that one of the individuals working there may be paying that rent for a car, but that would maybe be more of a lease. But there is another option that, you know, but my first guess is building that you, but there are a few other assets that they could be renting out. And
sure.
I don't know who to, but.
Yeah, they have to rent out about four or five, a pretty good fleet of cars for $17,000, but that's okay. I'm just trying to get through this, figure out exactly. And there are so many different questions in my mind as I look at this that it just doesn't seem like it's that we can make a easy decision that it's worth that we should sell shares at $100 a share, especially with the type of figures once they're annualized, it looks like a pretty viable business. I'm not sure which gentleman it was said they would pay $150 a share, but it sounds like that would be a pretty good deal. When you look at the interest that they pay on a monthly basis, they're showing $5,800 a month, so $72,000 a year. Do we know if that is all interest or if there's principal involved there too, since they have to pay off Wells Fargo?
I do not know the answer to that question. My guess would be that it is all principal, and most of that is probably Wells Fargo principal, because I do know that the notes payable on the liability section of about a little over $913,000, all of that except for between $100,000 and $200,000 is owed to Wells Fargo. So I'm presuming that interest is most of it that is due to Wells Fargo under the debt covenants of the bankruptcy plan. I do not believe that they would record principal in there, at least.
Right.
I wouldn't record principal in interest expense.
Well, like you say, you're right, and they made a couple of other changes here that a person of your stature would not be making either, such as the reserve for losses, showing it as a liability when they actually shows they have $350,000 funded, and if the $350,000 is a funded account, then it depends on how you're showing your assets and liabilities, but under these circumstances, showing it as a liability when in essence it's an asset, and then showing that they have reserve for depreciation, if those are all funded, then they have a couple $100,000 more, so they have about $550,000 in funded accounts that they're showing as liabilities.
But keep in mind, those are not assets. Those are contra assets. They are negative assets.
But if they're funded accounts, then they end up being a value. I know how they're subtracted here, and I
wouldn't say that the reserve for losses has any value. What that serves as an estimate of what they believe their bad debts expense for the year is going to be. And it's, according to GAAP, you list that as a contra asset. That should be listed right under the notes receivable of $2.9 million, and that $350,000 should be actually subtracted. It's got a credit balance, so therefore I think they're accounting software just threw it down into the liabilities, and the same with reserve for depreciation. It's got a credit balance, so maybe the way they set up their QuickBooks or whatever they're doing this, it just threw it down into the liabilities. But funded accounts.
Well, it'd be like if I had personally, if I had overpaid my income taxes for years, because I wanted to hide some cash, and I had $30,000 sitting in with the Internal Revenue Service. Is that a liability or is it an asset?
That's an asset because somebody owes you something back.
That's correct. And if I take that same amount of money and I put it in a savings account, it's my savings account, and I call it my building, which I claim is worth $44,000, and it's actually worth a couple $100,000, and I put it in as a reserve for depreciation on the building, then I've understated my asset on my building, and I've understated my financial assets on the amount of cash on hand. I'm concerned that there are potentially games being played on the finances. And my challenge is that there are so many questions that I just can't arrive at a conclusive position as to what the value is.
I will certainly agree to that statement.
Okay. Thank you.
And I might just, here's how I read that reserve for losses, Commissioner Hansen. I view that less as a savings account and more as, maybe I think it's mislabeled, although you're certainly right. We don't have good information to make that determination, but I almost read that as anticipated accounts receivable write-offs.
That is not a cash account. I think you stated it very accurately. That's anticipated. There's actually no money in any account. There's no dollars sitting there. It's just an anticipation. Same with depreciation. That is a non-cash account. There's no money sitting there. As you, every year when you take depreciation expense, at the end of the year when you close your books, that depreciation expense flows into your reserve account on the balance sheet. And it's just an accumulation of all the years of depreciation that you have taken.
That's correct. That's how it is supposed to be. And that's my question, is that how it actually is?
Your question to me is that I cannot answer that. I would have to assume that's what it is. But again, I'm making an assumption.
Right. Well, I won't cover the other questions that I have pertaining to it because I think that makes the point of my concerns. With valuations and with the amount of cash flow that they're showing and hard to tell what the true expenses are, I think we need to do a little more auditing to know that. And again, I'm reluctant to go through any more of a delay on it because I recognize how many of our assets are being devoted to this when we can be doing other things with our time for the taxpayers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, Ms. Wiest.
There's a new sheriff in town.
Any other questions from commissioners?
I do have a few more. You noted, Mr. Sanger, well, first I'll tell you that I'm referring to Exhibit 399, and that was a notice sent out to possible claimants that had not yet filed anything with this commission.
That is correct.
Can you give me a ballpark of how many of those were sent out? I mean, we're talking dozens or hundreds?
Hundreds. I can tell you that we believe that there were well over 600 customers of S&S Communications based on all the information we received from contacts from customers, from S&S information, and from the financing corporation. We have compiled a list of well over 600 customers. Now, this notice would have not been sent to those customers who we have on our list that already had a complaint filed with us or that already had a bond claim form filed with us. I don't know. I mean, we had 100 and some complaints. At that point, we probably had 50, 60 bond claim forms. So, you know, those 600 some customers minus who we already had information received that. I would say it was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 customers received that.
Do we have any rough idea of what percentage of the money that S&S owed to people was reported to the commission?
Reported when?
By claimants.
About, let me do some checking before I make a statement there. For landline long-distance service, that would be excluding investors, excluding wireless, and the various other things, I'm going to say it was about half of the dollars claimants actually made a claim on, of the dollars that we believe were was an unearned revenue by Aberdeen or by SNS Communications service that they needed to provide yet.
Thanks. Mr. Schenger, do you have much experience in your professional past with bankruptcies?
No.
Okay. Strike that question then. Thanks. One couldn't help but notice, well, let me not go there quite yet. Mr. Schenger, have you reviewed the bylaws or any other governing documents of Aberdeen Finance?
We have those. My review on them has been very limited. We received those about maybe a week ago, and my review has been very limited.
Well, I'll ask the question anyway on the off chance that you know the answer. Is there any right by a large shareholder or a majority shareholder to compel minority shareholders to sell their stock that you're aware of?
A right of large shareholders to compel the small holders to share their stock, to sell their stock. I do not believe, I am not aware of such a right in the bylaws.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm driving at. If you look at Exhibit 401, and that is the advice letter received by Camels Consulting. Or maybe it's CAMELS Consulting. In his second to final sentence of his advice, he notes, if I'm correct and there is a large shareholder that could flush out minority shareholders by minimizing income and buying their stock for $100 per share, then you have no choice but to bail out and take anything you can get for the stock. I didn't know if Mr. Rucker was speaking to some sort of a right that large shareholders had to be able to force out small shareholders.
I believe that he is addressing what could be viewed as an occurrence that can happen with closely held corporations. Essentially, if a majority of the stockholders, those who are in control, they control when and if ever dividends are paid. What I think he's referring to here is if several of the largest stockholders that represent a majority are able to have that control, they can make the decision to never pay a dividend. And I think that's what he's referring to there, is that if you've got your money tied up in stock in this corporation and you're never going to receive a dime for it, they can flush you out by making a minimal offer for those shares and essentially almost force you to accept it, because that's something rather than nothing.
Mr. Singer, were you surprised in the Kettle Thorstenson advice letter that there wasn't a greater discount for the lack of rights that are afforded to minority shareholders?
I was extremely surprised.
Were you surprised that there was not a greater discount taken for the lack of a liquidity of these stocks, the lack of a market?
Extremely surprised.
Do you have any basis in your professional experience to know what appropriate discount rates might be for those characteristics?
Yes, you can. There's formulas out there that you can discount, future values, various things like that. That could be calculated.
But you wouldn't have a professional opinion to what an appropriate discount rate would be.
I wouldn't call my opinion on that being professional, no.
Okay. My final question is, one couldn't help but notice that there was no staff recommendation provided, at least not that I heard of, what the commission should do with the stock. I know Commission staff has laid out a number of options. At least one additional option was put forth by Kel Thorstenson's advice letter. Did staff have a recommendation?
I can certainly make one. I think it may have been kind of an oversight. You do have two more professional opinions in front of you than my opinion. My opinion takes the information from these two opinions and additional information that I have and the luxury of knowing, not knowing, but having communicated with customers, S&S customers, and knowing that they are frustrated with this whole process, knowing that this thing is drug on forever. I one believe that, in my opinion, that a majority of these customers do not want the stock. What are you going to do with 1/100th of a share or 1/10th of a share? Our largest claimant would receive 3.5 shares. Everybody else would receive less than a share. So it's my opinion that I do not believe that distributing the stock is probably the best thing to do for the customers. I believe that pursuing a counteroffer that staff has already discussed in a small portion with Aberdeen Finance Corporation to accept the $6,000 offer, the $3,500 per share, and the $2,500 up front, accept that offer with a counter that they allow all of the S&S customers the option to purchase their portion of the shares back that they would have received had we distributed those shares, that they can buy those shares back for the $100 a share price. Granted, that would be prorated. If they receive 1/10th of a share, they would buy 1/10th back at $10. They couldn't necessarily buy more than those shares back because they can only buy their portion of the share back. I believe that is the commission's best offer at this point. It may not be the best financial decision come 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years down the road, but I firmly believe that that's what the customers want. They want finality to this.
I think it is likely in Exhibit 393. I lied. I have more questions.
Can I lie up here?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Keith, is that an option, or is that something we'd have to wait for, buying back the stocks?
What I can tell you is I can tell you everything, but we have had some preliminary discussions about such a counteroffer with Kathy Getty, who is the treasurer secretary, and another individual who I cannot remember his name, but he is also a stockholder. He is an attorney, and I think that he actually was an attorney for Aberdeen Finance Corporation and is kind of helping him through this process to save money for Aberdeen Finance Corporation. Whether he's getting paid or not, I don't know. But he is a stockholder, similar situation we're in. And the indication that we got is if the commission was to direct staff to make such a counteroffer, that they would seriously consider it. In fact, one indication was it sounded like a good idea. But we also told them point blank that it is our belief that very few of the S&S customers would actually take the option and buy the stock back. And that's my belief. I may be totally wrong there, but that's my belief, is that very few would take that stock purchase back option and go that route. Now, granted, again, as we'd indicated in a previous meeting, that all of this is subject to Wells Fargo approving this.
Mr. Sanger, in Exhibit 393, which is the package of materials regarding Aberdeen Finance Corporation, the April 6th letter from Aberdeen Finance, which tenders some kind of an offer for the stock and the $2,500. Do you have the exhibit in front of you?
I do.
Now, the second to last paragraph on that page says, there is the possibility that one of the shareholders would be willing to pay the $2,500 cash balance. The word possibility is a little troubling. In conversations you've had with Ms. Getty or others from AFC, do you have a reason to believe that possibility is a probability or even something more than that?
I believe it is definitely stronger than a possibility. I do not believe it is 100% certain. It's my belief that this would be an individual who would take care of this portion of the offer. I believe that individual is possibly someone who is a stockholder in the company. I actually believe it may be part of the Rich family themselves, which would include Kathy Getty. I do not know that, but that's what I believe. But she has indicated that it's more of a probability than a possibility. And she couldn't give me any guarantees, but she said if we could make this work, she would see to it that that took place.
Mr. Sanger, it seems to me that the only piece of leverage that this commission has over Aberdeen Finance is the specter of us distributing shares. I suspect that that is not something AFC wants. Do we weaken our counteroffer stance by taking share distribution off the table?
Do we repeat your question again?
Do we weaken our counteroffer strategic positioning by taking the distribution of shares off the table? I mean, at some point, if AFC if AFC has reason to believe that if $100 is all we can get, then $100 is what we'll take, it doesn't put us in a very good negotiating position. In what ways am I wrong?
Let me answer your question this way. I do know that Aberdeen Finance Corporation has indicated to me personally that they do not want another 250-some stockholders. They do not want fractional shares. They do not want that. That is a bargaining tool. There's no doubt. Do we weaken our offer? Do we weaken our leverage against Aberdeen Finance Corporation? Yes, I believe we do somewhat. But I tend to look at it as, on a personal standpoint, I don't believe that we should be looking at it that way. My goal here in making recommendations to the commission is to do the best thing for the customers. Although it is a leveraging possibility that we have, I do not believe that we should use such a leveraging tool if it's going to hurt or cause problems for the claimants. I do not believe it's in the best interest. Let me just state it this way. I don't believe it's in the best interest of the SNS customers, the claimants, to receive these shares.
Thanks, Ms. Weiss. That's all I have.
Any other questions? Greg?
Oh, go ahead.
Greg Ruslow. Keith, I read these letters. They just came in, I believe, yesterday, last night, whatever, so no one's had a lot of time to go over them, and I'm referring to the letters from the consultants trying to attach a value to those shares of stock. As I read it, both those analyses, we're viewing it, the firm as an ongoing business, and the stockholders is owning a portion of that business, roughly, or I guess exactly 35 shares. Would you say that's correct?
I would.
Now, it's my understanding the value of investment is determined by the ability of the investee or investor, excuse me, to extract a return on and return of their investment. And I think I've heard you answer that question a number of times today, and I know you're not an attorney, but you know, if there's a portion of this that I find troubling, it's knowing, and I think Commissioner Johnson just used the word leverage, if there is leverage, or if in a corporation such as AFC, if there's the ability to actually extract from that company, and let's say they're very successful in the next several years and we're willing to wait for 5 or 6 years to realize any return, if there is the ability of a minority, a very small minority, less than 10% of the shareholders, to extract a return on and a return of whatever capital they may have in that business or whatever value we're talking about on these letters, the CAMELS letter or the Kettle Thorstenson letter. And, again, I realize you're a non-attorney, but has there been any review? Is there any knowledge of what ability we would have or these potentially very small shareholders would have in extracting that value?
I have not done any review. The only information that I can give regarding that is my personal opinion of the dilemma of a minority stockholder in a closely held corporation. But I have not done any review, whether on a legal end or on a financial end, of what power they would have. But I do believe the power is extremely limited.
Any further questions from commissioners? If not, any redirect, Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chairman, did you have a question? Just a couple of things, Keith. With respect to the financial statements and their accuracy, at least, looking at those, are they anomalous from what one might normally expect to see from a GAAP reporting public company, for example?
There are, let me answer, I'm not sure I quite grasp what you're asking, but there are things reported in here that are not GAAP compliant. Yes.
Even the state, the actual labeling of the one statement is not what you'd see with any kind of SEC reporting company, is it?
Yeah, but one thing I do want to note is that this entity resembles a bank. And there are certain exceptions, different account names, various things that banking type institutions do. I do not have a lot of knowledge regarding the differences. The differences aren't vast, but they do account for some things a little bit differently than a mining institution or a industrial business or whatever. But yes, some of the account names are, I'm not going to say abnormal, but did cause me to pause and look and think about exactly what they're recording in those accounts. But there again, the name on the account means nothing. I mean, you can name it whatever you want, just so long as you know what's in that account and what it's tracking.
With respect to the trust, what we might have in the financial statements, I mean, approximately how far are we away from the order confirming bankruptcy plan? Do you recall when that, it's on the exhibit, it's on the front page of exhibit 3A. Wait a minute. My old one was bad here. I think it's 389.
The order is dated September 11th, 2006. So we're.
So they've only been out from under the supervision of the trustee, and they're still not totally out from under, but actively since then. Is that a probability?
That is correct. But I would still say that this plan does have various covenants that they have to follow, or they could be back into bankruptcy fairly quickly.
And are two of those covenants, if we look on page 10 of the plan?
I do not have page 10.
Oh, you're missing that. Here's the one they recopied correctly.
Okay.
And if we look at those, if we look at paragraphs 10, 11, and 15, and then on the previous pages, loan covenants, and I guess does that give you a little additional comfort that the records they're keeping are at least reasonably accurate?
Yes. I do know that they have to provide this information to the bank. I can't remember how often. It's probably in one of these covenants without reading it. But the bank does get a copy of these all the time. It's my belief that these financial statements are not... There are some errors in there, but I do not believe that they are grossly misstated. But I have nothing to lead me to believe that they're grossly misstated. When you make some of the movements back and forth and change some of the credit accounts that should be a contra asset from the liabilities and do various things like that, I don't believe that they are grossly misstated by any means. I do have some confidence in what I have. But I make that statement without doing any auditing, without doing any look, just doing a review of the statements that I have seen.
Well, just to clarify again, and I think you talked about this, but again, at least under normal accounting practices, a reserve for doubtful accounts is in no way a cash account, is it?
Correct. It is a contra asset that actually acts as an estimated bad debts expense that they record on their balance sheet.
And its purpose is simply to make a fair adjusting entry to properly reflect the true value of a receivables account.
It's kind of a forward-looking account to try and estimate what the value of their asset is.
As to the leverage issue with shareholders, would you agree that, we've made the threat, and we made the offer to the shareholders. Is that a fair statement? Is that what we see when we see that series of letters?
Yeah, we have made the threat not only in those letters, but on the phone when I was speaking with Kathy Getty, I mentioned it again. I said, I don't believe that you guys want these customers on there. And her response was, Keith, because of Wells Fargo and because of the situation that we're in right now, this is the absolute most that Wells Fargo themselves would ever approve while we are under their debt covenants. I indicated that way. Is there a possibility that one of the stockholders themselves might want to buy these shares, not Aberdeen Finance Corporation buying them back, putting it back into their treasury? And she indicated to me that that offer was made to all the stockholders themselves, and nobody accepted that offer. What that tells me is that even the shareholders that are running the business today are not confident enough in the business to raise their price over the $100 per share. They don't have the ability to because of debt covenants and control by Aberdeen Finance Corporation, and nor do they have the any stockholders that even want more shares.
It is a fact, is it not, that I mean that this offer was made to us with knowledge that if we rejected it, the probable consequence would be a distribution of shares.
We clearly indicated to them that if this offer gets accepted, that we may likely be moving toward distribution of shares. And she indicated to me, well, you guys, you know, if that's what you guys have to do, that's what has to be done. So, yes.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Any other questions?
Mr. Sanger, Mr. Smith asked about Wells Fargo, and you mentioned that Ms. Getty had mentioned that Wells Fargo wouldn't allow them to pay anything more than $100 per share. Have we verified that with anyone at Wells Fargo?
No, I have not discussed that with Wells Fargo.
Okay. There was also a line of question by Mr. Smith regarding the financial reports. And also note, you know, it seems as though you and as well as some of the commissioners have concerns about, and I think both of the advice letters also mentioned that there's not complete information there. Did we make any attempt to request additional financial information or reports from AFC?
I did not. And if I did get anything, the only relevant information that a person could get would date back to September 11th would be their starting point. September 11th that date was? Their post-bankruptcy date when they came out of that order. So that would be part of September, October, November, December. There's 4 months of information that we don't have. Now, keep in mind the balance sheet is a snapshot in time, so we have that information that's been updated. The only additional information that would give us is approximately 3.5 months of income statement type information. But no, I have not requested that information.
Mr. Sanger, if the commissioners decided that $100 was an unacceptable price per share, would you have any secondary recommendation?
I would recommend.
And that's probably, that question is actually probably out of order since Mr. Smith didn't ask him about that. But
I'll give you leeway.
Thank you very much, Ms. Weiss. Sorry, Mr. Sanger, go ahead.
Now, let me try and clarify that. Is that including the counteroffer? If you guys decide we don't even want a counteroffer, we don't want the $100 per share, we don't want a counteroffer, what would my next recommendation be?
That's right.
I still believe the last thing we want to do at this point is distribute the shares. That's my personal viewpoint. And I base that solely on if I was an SNS claimant, I would not want those shares. I would not want the hassle. So that would be my absolute last recommendation to you. If you guys decide to not accept the $100, I believe about the only option left is to hold the shares for a period of time and hope in the future we get a better offer. In that time, we would get $2,500 paid over 4 years, which is of far less value than getting $2,500 paid today because of the present value. And I firmly believe that such a recommendation may be lacking in the fact that because of the lack of power that the commission has, even let me put it this way, even if the company becomes extremely successful, they're able to pay all their debt and make money hand over fist, I am not convinced that our bargaining power would allow us to extract, if you want to use that term, more than $100 per share.
Thank you.
I believe it would be out of the goodness of their heart to do such.
Thanks very much, Mr. Singer. Ms. Weiss, thank you.
Any other questions?
Can I ask Mr. Smith a question, or just?
If you can ask him a question, but anything that he states is not evidence.
Okay. Well, and maybe Keith can answer this. Are we taking leeway with this trying to propose a value for these stocks, or is our custodial duty to just distribute what we have collected? Are we stretching things, or are we in the right frame of mind, or have we gotten kind of off track?
I believe our custodial duty is to distribute proceeds. Now, to me, not being an attorney, I believe that means when we get cash, when we get money, we have to distribute that. Regarding the shares, I suppose you could view those as proceeds, but we've had discussions about this, whether that is the duty of us to distribute those. I think one could very easily come to the conclusion that it's our duty to distribute those, but I don't think we can overlook the duty to try and do what's best for the consumers. But there is a question, and I believe it's probably a legal question, of whether or not we are obligated to distribute these shares. Now, can we sit on these shares for 10 years and never look at them? No, I do not believe that would – I believe we'd be violating our custodial duty not to do anything with them, just to let them sit there for – but I think that our duty is to try and maximize proceeds. And if that means distributing those shares to the customers because we can't get anything for them, then that would be our duty.
If you look in Mr. Thorson's, it says the benefit, if you look at number two on the second page, it says the benefit to the creditor group would be that if AFC then decided to redeem the fractional shares, they must pay full undiscounted appraisal value without the discount. Do you see that as an option? The way, maybe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I'm reading that is if we fractionalize these shares and they go up to AFC and say, I want this share in, is that an obligation that they have to abide by?
When I first read that, I believe that he is indicating that the threat of distribution would be enough to get Aberdeen Finance Corporation to pay something more than $100 per share. As I read it again, it may be something different, but what I will state is I don't care who has the shares, whether it be the commission or whether it be the claimants, that I don't believe that we will ever have the bargaining power or the force to have Aberdeen Finance Corporation pay us book value for those shares if Aberdeen Finance Corporation decides not to do so. I don't believe that we can force them to do anything. The whole problem behind this is we're powerless. I mean, on a closely held corporation, you don't have to distribute. There's nothing forcing anyone to distribute if the majority stockholder, whether that be one, two, three, four people, if they decide to not make any distributions and pay themselves in extremely high wages, they can do that. 10 years down the road when this company's doing well, we may never see a dividend, and they could pay the majority stockholders, make them employees, and pay them that way. There's nothing stopping them from doing that. They can do whatever they want. There may be some legal method that you can do to force it out. I do not know of. But I just don't see how he can make a statement that we can extract book value out of these shares.
Okay.
I just don't want to get into the... I want to eliminate the doubters or whatever that we could have, you know, could have, would have, should have, obviously. And in my mind, I'm just thinking that it would be, and well, I disagree with your analysis. I think it would be cut and dried if we just took the shares and divided them up equally and be done with it. That would alleviate our custodial duty and move on. Now, whether we got more or less or anything like that, that's yet to be seen. But I guess those are my concerns, is our custodial duty to bargain and find the best price, or is it just this is what we've gotten, this is what the court, bankruptcy court said we get? Is it just our custodial duty to just distribute that?
You know, and maybe this isn't a question, maybe I'm speaking a little bit out of turn, but I do believe that besides our custodial duty to distribute proceeds, I believe the commission is here to protect the consumers. And if distributing the shares is the only option that we have, the only viable option, then that's what must be done. But I also believe that we need to watch out for those consumers and do what we can for them. And, you know, I've stated my opinion on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we've heard from several of the customers. I'm wishing I would have heard from more. My guess is if I would have heard from more, we would have got more of the same. Take the money and run and get it paid out. I personally would want the ability to choose what I invest in, not have someone decide what I'm going to invest in myself.
Well put. Thank you.
Commissioner Hansen.
Keith, I hate prolonging this, but I just want to ask one question. It's a yes or a no, please. Have you seen the bylaws for this corporation?
Yes, I've seen them.
Why haven't those been introduced to us as evidence? Excuse me.
I will mark them and have Keith introduce them. I have them right here. Pardon me. We certainly could have done that.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And is it...
do you have a sticker?
Who?
Can we take
just a second? Go ahead.
Certainly.
Foundation.
Commissioners, are you going to want to see copies of that document?
I am going to want to look at it, yes.
Right now?
No.
But not right now?
Correct.
Okay. I guess the answer is no for right now. Because if we're going to get copies, then we got to get her going and get them.
I simply need to ask... question then of whether I'm permitted to or someone else can, how do I introduce to as evidence if I'm curious about valuation of a property, for instance, just want to get a ballpark figure and check with the Director of Equalization for property tax valuation. Can I do that, or am I not permitted to even engage in that?
That might be better directed to your counsel up there than me.
Well, I would think if you wanted additional evidence, what the best course would be to direct staff to gather that evidence.
All right. Thank you.
That sounds fine.
I don't have any further questions at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Keith, do you, commissioners, otherwise we probably should get the new exhibit, the bylaws, introduced. Is that's a document that you requested from Kathy Geddes, is it not?
Correct.
And you received that from her?
Correct.
Directly?
Correct.
And do you recognize that as the document we received?
Yes.
And back about three-fourths of the way to the back is the share restrictions. Is that, could you take a find of that? It's referenced in the share certificate.
Okay. say I have the article, sheriff certificates and transfers. What are you looking for?
I think there's some smaller print, and I don't have a copy of it now, so.
Okay, referring to transfer of shares. We have certificate of shares, section 1, section 2, transfer of shares.
The smaller print.
Well, I don't see any smaller print.
Isn't that single-spaced? I mean, that's single, what I mean. Single-spaced,
okay, yes.
Sorry.
Restriction on transfer, section 3.
Right, and have you read that before today?
Completely no. I have read portions of it.
I mean, I know what it says, but I'm not the witness here, but if you took a quick read of it, doesn't it say that whenever a person is going to transfer shares, that they're required to give notice to the corporation and permit the corporation to give them 15 days to purchase the shares on the same terms?
Yes. Section 3, item paragraph A, mentions the 15 days as you just discussed.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Going to offer it.
Oh, hey, pardon me. I'd like staff would offer exhibit 404.
It's been admitted. Any further questions of this witness? If not, thank you. Mr. Smith, do you have another witness?
Yes, Heather Forney, please. Staff would call Heather Forney.
Are you planning to call Mr. Shepik as a witness?
I could, and maybe we could do that first. Heather's literally going to be 2 minutes. Seriously.
Well, I just didn't know if, out of courtesy, maybe an out-of-office witness allowed them
sure.
to go home for dinner as opposed.
Yeah, we could do that. And again, this is probably more, I had not intended to call Gail. I guess what I would do is.
And I don't mean to force a witness on you, Mr. Smith. I mean, if you're either not prepared or not interested in calling Mr. Shepik, I mean, please don't do so.
Well, I'll put it this way. I don't really have a whole lot of questions to ask of Gail, but it does occur to me that the commissioners maybe ought to have the opportunity to address some of your questions to him. He was kind enough. I asked him if he could possibly be here today, and he was kind enough to be here and sit through a whole lot of boring stuff. So we might at least show him the courtesy to see what he thinks. Thank you. So I guess staff will call Gail Shepik. Gail, would you please state and spell your name for the reporter?
My name's Gail Shepik. That's G-A-I-L. Last name is S-H-E-P-P-I-C-K.
And by whom are you employed?
By the state of South Dakota.
In what position?
I'm the director of securities.
Can you give us just a very brief rundown of what that job entails?
We regulate the offer and sale of securities, the registration of securities, broker dealers, franchises, business opportunities, everything to do with securities we regulate.
Is there a minimum business size where you can't regulate them?
No.
So a company like Aberdeen Finance with 78 shareholders and a relatively small company still falls under your jurisdiction?
Yes, they do.
Have we provided you with some of the information regarding that we have, including the bylaws, the letters back and forth with Aberdeen Finance, the bankruptcy plan, et cetera?
Yes.
And you've had a chance to review that information in the context of the financial statements that were provided along with that in the context of that back and forth among us involving this situation.
Yes.
And maybe based on that, and rather than be too question and answer about this, because I think really what I'd like to get to is to get to where the commissioners can kind of just pick your brain a little bit about what you think. And you've seen the offer that we made to sell for 1,000 shares, which honestly I still feel was a reasonable offer. You know, it's we're offering to sell at a discount to book. You've also seen that at their annual meeting, the shareholders of Aberdeen Finance rejected that offer, despite knowing that the probable alternative is we would distribute fractional shares to 260 people. Maybe you could just share with the commission some of your thoughts about that.
Okay.
And then at some point here, I'd also like to see what you think maybe about particularly the idea of the auction that Mr. Thorstensen suggested in his recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, members of this commission, I'm pleased to be here today to talk about some of these issues because I think you're faced with a difficult situation here as to valuation. I think what you have to do as far as valuation goes, what will the market bring today? I mean, isn't that what happens on the New York Stock Exchange every day? These are not freely traded securities. This is a private company. These are unregistered securities. You can't have a public auction and expose that security to the public. That's a public offering. So you can't do that. So what have you done? You've gone to the insiders. You've gone to the people who exchanged their debt for securities. The people that you went to sell these things to exchanged their debt, $3,500 for each share, and not one of them want to buy it. You got to remember, they exchanged $3,500 in debt for each share that they got, and none of them want it. You've got a small, few member family that own this thing until bankruptcy, and then it spread out, of course, to the creditors of the company. And the insiders don't even want to give you more than $100, and you have no more leverage in the world that is more effective than to have a small privately held company that faces the fact that all of a sudden the commission can cause me to have 300 and some odd more shareholders. Every time I have a meeting, I can't even afford the postage now. That is the biggest leverage that you could ever have on a privately held company. I'm telling you, they're getting close enough to the number of shareholders. If they had $1 million net worth, you could force them into being a reporting company, which is extremely costly. So, when you go to a company like this and you say, if you don't buy these securities, we're going to distribute them, and everybody's going to have a fractional share, and you're going to have to send notices to everybody, that's about as big a threat as you're going to get. And so, I don't know how you place value. I'm not an accountant. Thank goodness after listening to this today that I didn't become a CPA rather than an attorney, because I'm telling you that. But yes, do minority shareholders have rights? Yes, they cannot be oppressed. And you could go for 10 years, and if they had lots of money and never paid a dividend, yes, the minority shareholders could sue and force the majority to pay dividends. But the issue here today is that none of us are clairvoyant. And you've got all the leverage in the world today to make that decision, and you find no takers. No insiders will even offer up over $3,500. And you can bet those insiders can afford $3,500. So I'm not trying to convince you one way or another what to do. But to me, I think that's what you have to go back to. And I mean, there's your market. These are not freely transferable. They're restricted. I just saw a deal the other day on an ethanol plant. I mean, this ethanol plant is worth like $300 or $400 million. And they were trying to decide the value of security so they could have a reverse stock split. and it's not a publicly traded company. And this analysis was done by experts that cost a fortune. I mean, when you got it, it was a thick book of every kind of analysis you can imagine. And even a company this size that had, excuse me, that had paid shareholders back over five times their investment already was discounted 20% on the value of those shares simply because it wasn't publicly traded. And that's by the experts. Can you imagine what a company like Aberdeen Finance would be discounted? I mean, I don't know where they come up with these values, but in my opinion, I think the commission has done its due diligence. Whether it's a bad mistake or not, who knows? You might hold those 2 years and they're worth a fortune, but you got to make your decision based on what you know today. And what you know today is that there's no market. And you've got as much leverage as you'll ever have. And that is a distribution to 300 more people. Nobody wants 300 more shareholders in a small company. It has no advantage to them whatsoever. And it's not like, well, so what if I got 300? It's not that simple. I got to deal with them from now on. It's not... I guess that's about all I have to say, unless you have any questions.
Any questions from the commissioners?
I do have a couple of clarifying questions. First off, I'd like to say, Mr. Shevick, thank you very much for your comments. I'm not trying to chase you out of state government, but you would have been one of the best professional witnesses we've ever had here if you'd been paid. So thanks for your service to the state.
Well, thank you.
I want to make sure I heard you right on two things. First off, you're saying that the law would not currently allow the Public Utilities Commission to auction these shares. That option is not legally available to us.
No, that's not available.
Okay. And secondly, you said that you're not trying to advise us one way or the other. But it seems to me, and I want to make sure that I'm reading I'm listening to your advice right here. All of your points to advice really scream the recommendation, sell, sell, sell. Am I mischaracterizing your testimony?
Well, unlike you, I don't want to commit myself to that. But let's face it, this was a family-run business. They at one time, in order to operate the way they used to operate, and they did for years, was they sold people promissory notes. Could I get a drink of water just a second?
Yeah, sure.
The way these people operated, and I got involved with them as in a securities aspect, was that they were just selling everybody promissory notes. That's where they got the money to loan out. Well, they can't do that anymore. So I don't know how that affects them. I mean, they could have a public offering if they wanted. But, we wouldn't let them sell anymore. I mean, they were selling unregistered securities in the form of promissory notes. And so... they can't do that anymore. And at that time, just a handful of people owned that company. And like I said, then when they went through bankruptcy, then the bankruptcy court distributed shares for debt. And now they're saying we don't even care if 300 and something more shareholders come on board with fractional shares. I don't know. It seems to me like they've told you themselves what they think the company's worth. And you've been fair because you've offered it to people who just exchanged their debt, $3,500 debt for that. And they don't want it either. So, all of the people that are so-called interested parties in this thing have had a chance to look at this. And sure, there's always a speculator out there, if you could find one, you know, that says, gee, I'll give you $10,000 as a gamble. But it's a private company. You can't be out publicly soliciting to sell an insolvent company by the government. I mean, you don't even know if these financials are accurate that you give the buyer. I mean, the liability there is tremendous. So, you know, that's my opinion.
Thanks very much.
Any other questions?
And we thank you very, very much for your opinion, Mr. Shepik. No disrespect to our analyst, Mr. Sanger. I feel like another window's been opened here and some more fresh air has come in on the subject. I really appreciate your opening remarks and testimony. Just one question. In your opening remarks, you said that there was a point at which the company could reach, and I believe you said the 1 million mark, and then they could be forced into being regulated by shareholders?
If you have a company and you have over 500 shareholders and a net worth of $1 million, you become what's called a reporting company. And what that basically under the theory is that if you get that many people out there holding shares of a privately held company, the law says you're not private anymore, whether you like it or not. And so you have to start filing with the SEC quarterly financials, annual financials. They're called 10-Qs and 10-Ks. And you can look up any company that's a reporting company on an electronic system called EDGAR. And so that's how securities become freely tradable, because if you're a reporting company, you don't have to be registered per se. And because when somebody wants to buy your stock, they have access to immediate information about that company. And they can look them up and say, well, do I want to invest in here or not? Whereas private companies, you may not have that kind of information.
Thank you very, very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other questions from the commissioners or advisors? Mr. Smith?
Just one, Gail, on the other counteroffer that Keith and I made, or we've discussed. We haven't made a counteroffer, and we're not going to do so unless the commissioners think it's a good idea. But the idea of accepting the money, but subject to obviously firming up the kind of mushy $2,500 offer to also prepay that debt obligation. And secondly, the idea of giving, we would do this only on condition, we would accept it only on the condition that AFC would then issue a stock option back to each claimant, each person who gets a distribution of stock from us, and that option would give them the option. Every one of those claimants then would have the option at his own election, whether it's a buck, which is the lowest number anybody's going to get, a dollar, up to the highest is going to be in the the several thousand dollars worth of whatever, several hundred dollars, I should say, here. And afford them the option. You know, if they think putting their money back into Aberdeen Finance is what they want to do, they would then be absolutely free to do it. Now that I've laid that kind of groundwork, as I understand the exemptions from the necessity for registration, that option issued back to existing beneficial owners of stock, would that be covered by an exemption sufficiently to where Aberdeen Finance could legally offer that to these people?
Well, I guess, I mean, legally right now, the beneficiaries own these securities. And if you take the position that they own these securities currently, then they're an already existing security holders, and there is an exemption to resell somebody who already holds the security of the same company. And so, you know, there would be an exemption to offer them an option to buy those back. The only problem is you've got fractional shares, and I don't know how you're ever going to deal with that.
Well, I think we would, in doing that, of course, at a minimum, I think we would want to have conditions that prevented the use of the scrip option, you know, this for the company and certain other things, and just compelled them to issue these fractional shares.
Well, you'd have to issue a whole share. I mean, I think the option should be that Aberdeen would give them the right to purchase back. I can't see where a person can buy a fractional share. I think, and I'd have to look it up in under corporate law, that's not a securities per se issue. It's a corporate law issue, and I can't remember. I don't know that you can issue a fractional share.
Well, that's something we can check. People wind up with fractional shares all the time.
They wind up with them,
but
I don't know if you can issue one.
That's something maybe we'll have to check on that.
I'm not sure about that, but that would be a question mark there.
That's a good question.
But other than that, yeah, I suppose that you could do it.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Well, I'll just note, I mean, Mr. Shepik's suggestion is a fine one. I shouldn't say certainly. I wouldn't see anything wrong with the option being for, you know, up to the nearest whole share.
That's certainly, I mean, we can counteroffer anything we want as long as it's lawful.
Sure. Thanks.
Yep.
I mean, that's what I would do.
Any more questions for this witness?
I don't.
If not, thank you, Mr. Sheppy. May you call your next witness, Mr. Smith?
Staff calls Heather Forney.
While she's coming up, Mr. Smith, I had a question on Exhibits 1 through 384. Are they considered to be confidential?
Yes, there is highly confidential information, and thank you for reminding me.
And so that would just be two then. I mean, the 1 through 384 and 396 would be the only confidential.
Yes.
Thank you.
Would you please state and spell your name for the record?
Heather Forney, Forney, assuming you know how to spell the Heather.
And where are you employed?
I'm employed by the Public Utilities Commission here in Pierre.
And what's your position?
I'm the Deputy Executive Director.
And with respect to what we're going to be talking about today, which you know, What duties do you perform on behalf of the executive director and the commission?
With respect to what we're going to be discussing today, part of my duties involve the receipt of money and disbursement of such.
Would you please look at Exhibit 4, Staff 400? Do you recognize that document?
Yes, I do.
Who prepared that document?
I prepared that document.
Would you please explain to the commissioners what they see on what page one is? And maybe just, Heather, why don't you just, in the interest of time, just kind of go through the whole thing, walk us through it, and we won't waste a lot of time here.
What this is the amount of cash available to disperse from proceeds from S&S, from the bonds. We have $30,000 in a money market account, and then we have two CDs. One with a value of $80,747.19, and a second CD with a value of $79,559.49. So total cash available to disperse is $190,306.68. If you go to the second page, that's just a copy of the check that we got for $30,000 from Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company. that was received on December 13th, 2006. That is the one that's in the money market account. I don't have a recent statement from that one. The page after that is a copy of the most recent statement I have from Wells Fargo on the CD showing that $80,000 balance. These only come every 3 months because they're three-month term CDs, and they are automatically renewing those for us every 3 months. So that statement was for the period ending 04-2207. And then the last sheet is for the final CD, the statement that I have from Wells Fargo showing a balance of just under $80,000, and that was with the maturity date of March 9th, 07.
At this point in time, then, these CDs have all matured?
They're not. They're currently in the CD. The money's still in the CDs. What we, I didn't want to pull the money out of the CDs because I wasn't sure when the disbursement was going to be made by the commissioners, and wanted to earn as much interest as we could for the consumers.
At this point in time, is there any restriction in terms of where these funds are invested on when that disbursement could be made?
There is. If you look at the actual maturity notices for both of those CDs, it does talk about a penalty for early withdrawal. So, for example, the one that the maturity date is July 22nd, 2007, there is a penalty for early withdrawal, but it's minimal. I'm thinking it was on that first page.
Yeah, I just don't see anything on there, but
yeah, I know it says it. Let me. I have the actual CD here, so let me see if it's on the back.
My only reason for asking is just to know if we're talking, you know, what the time frame is when, without a material penalty, we might realistically be able to disperse, and that'll give us an idea then, planning wise, as to how much time we can expend in perhaps further studying this stock business and some of the rest of it.
The back of the CD does speak about early withdrawals. It says a fee will be imposed for early withdrawal. If the term is less than 3 months, the early withdrawal fee is 1 month. Sorry. Early withdrawal. If the term is less than 3 months, the early withdrawal fee is 1 month's interest on the principal amount withdrawn, or a minimum fee of $25.
So we're talking, are we talking peanuts?
Yes.
If we, so realistically, the disbursement of funds, if the commission accepts our suggestion that it be done, as you know, with respect to the cash we have now, as soon as possible following expiration of the appeal date, that's something that would not be unduly penalizing to claimants to achieve.
That's correct.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Any questions?
Oh, pardon me. I'd like to offer the exhibit, Exhibit 400.
Exhibit 400 has been admitted. Any questions from the commissioners? Not. Thank you, Ms. Forney. Do you have any other witnesses, Mr. Smith?
I do not.
Do you have any closing?
You know, we've been here an awful long time today. You've heard a lot from me about this. You know, I concur in Mr. Shepik's characterization that it's just one of those nasty decisions on the stock. My suggestion, truthfully, would be, I mean, I'm going to recommend wholeheartedly that we take prompt action to approve to grant the motion, and I actually have I prepared a draft motion in case you want to see it, relative to the money and relative to the claim fraction determinations and the claim amount determinations. And I think we should get that done and get this over with, and the sooner the better. That settles all of the issues with respect to the claimant's relative entitlement to proceeds. I think it's maybe for a long time we've assumed that we may not have all of the proceeds on the very day that we make the first distribution. I think that's been in one of the assumptions we've thought is a clear possibility for a long time. So I don't think I would delay action on that for very long. I think we should move this along, get that appeal time going, and get that going, and get the funds out. In terms I don't think I can add any more to what we've already covered as to why and whether our recommendations are appropriate. We've beat that to death, and I think we've done the best job we can figure out how to do in that regard. We've been just working on this now for night and day for the last couple of months, and not that there may not still be some kind of an error in there somewhere, but I can tell you that I believe we've done the best that we can to do the right thing. With respect to the stock, you know, you've heard Mr. Shepik, you've heard a lot of different opinions expressed on this. I don't really have a strong opinion personally. I really don't. Except that we do have an obligation under the statute, which is 4934A117, to disperse proceeds that we get. And, you know, does that mean today, tomorrow? Again, I don't know. And does proceeds mean money or does it mean whatever we get? I'm inclined to think it means at some point we have an obligation to give these people what is theirs. And I don't know. There's some reasonable balancing sometimes against the duty to your obligation to look out for the best interests of claimants, but your other obligation to treat them as free American citizens and let them look out for their own interests. And I think that's the balancing that needs to be done. You know, and I think there's two or three decent options here. I think one is just to accept the offer they've made. I think the other one, I don't think it's a ridiculous option to just make an out-and-out distribution of the stock. That is the proceeds we got. It's their property. And lastly, I don't think a ridiculous option would be to pursue a counter-proposal that would allow that we would accept the offer, but only on the condition that they also offer each claimant an option. And again, the precise terms of that option may be to be defined by the commission. If you want it to be a minimum of one share, maybe that's what it has to be. Legally, I'd have to check that out to see. I did take a look at the corporation law. I don't recall seeing anything in there that specifically prohibited the issuance of a fractional share. But it's a huge chapter of the code. You know, there's hundreds of sections, and I'm not going to warrant to you today. So on that issue, if you want to explore something like that, I'd certainly, along with your general counsel here, want to burrow into that and make sure that what we're doing is lawful. And so with that, I'm going to conclude, unless you have any questions of me.
Is the hearing done, Ms. Weiss? Have you relinquished your powers, or are you still running?
Yes, the hearing is done.
Okay. Solely for discussion's sake, I think I may offer up a straw man here, so you have something to poke holes at. I would, two-part motion. First, I would move that the commission grant the motion by staff to deny, consolidate, and accept those claims as marked on, I think it's on E. Pardon?
And allow,
that's right. Not accept, but rather allow. Secondly, I would move that the commission accept the offer of Aberdeen Finance Corporation with two conditions. First, that the $2,500 cash payment be firmed up, and secondly, that a stock option is made available to anyone who wants it to purchase up to as many shares as they had, rounded up to the nearest whole share. Obviously, there's a limit of 35 shares, and so that would be on a first-come, first-served basis. And I'd make that again just as a stalking horse so we can have some discussion. Oh, thank you very much. Commissioner Hansen just asked if that would be on the weighted or the straight line allocation, and I would amend my motion to include a straight line allocation method as recommended by staff. Any discussion on the motion?
I guess on the stock options there, what would happen if that, are we sure that's a legal option? Yale had mentioned some other things about that.
I think, you know, just looking at it again, I think it is. If one considers that the offer is made as part of a transaction involving existing shareholders, and I think it is. I really do. There is another exemption under the security, under the South Dakota securities law that allows for exemption of an isolated transaction, which I think this clearly is.
Okay.
But I think it is an offer back to existing security holders, and I, you know, to me, the director seemed to think there was no problem, and so, you know, I think it's just giving them the opportunity mm-hmm. to make their own decision as to whether they think that investment is a better option than getting some money.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. How are we going to determine who's going to be in charge of, if we have a stock option, who's going to be in charge of, okay, here's your $9 or here's your... Are we just going to give them the $9 and then...
Yeah, I thought we'd just distribute all money. Okay. The money's in your pocket, and then you have to make an affirmative decision
okay.
pursuant to the terms of the option. And I, you know, I guess I'm really, just not to be, I'm getting tired here today
yeah.
for one thing, and, but I am terribly sick of this. But
yeah.
On the other hand, I it did occur to me that I'd probably end up having to draft the option myself.
Okay.
In order to make sure that it's in what I thought I'd do, it'd be very similar to that claim thing where we would have Keith then unload the data right into the document and have it all set up and do it for him, you know, and we would mail it out with the proceeds. That was the way I envisioned doing this.
So in a sense, we're gonna accept their deal. We're going to the other $2,500 and then work out, and hopefully AFC will let them buy back.
Yes.
And will there, do we need a motion? Does it need to be included in the motion that we set a timeline? We don't, obviously we don't want this lingering on for years and years and someone coming back at us and saying a year later, hey, I wanted to invest in them. They're great and I never got my chance. So
I think
the motion need to include time?
I don't think that's an inappropriate thing. I wouldn't make it maybe too short. Aberdeen Finance will, of course, I believe, I think in terms of this option business, they're going to have to hold a shareholders meeting
okay.
in order to approve that. So they're going, and they're in the bylaws, and but I it's sitting over there. But they're going to need at least some time frame. Most of their other deadlines on notices related to shares and that are 15 days. So maybe if you put it out at 30 days or within 30 days, something like that.
30 days after acceptance or rejecting of the option.
Well, or you mean on the option. You mean the people's.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, the terms of the option. Yeah, I think Aberdeen Finance will, they're not going to want that option hanging out there forever.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I thought you meant by when we want a response back from Aberdeen Finance to
okay.
fish or cut bait. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. And
I
think that's a good idea,
too. I'm wondering the timeline. You know, we want to make sure that when the deal is done, it's done for the PUC and the customer. We don't, you know, I'd like to know how much time they have to buy into AFC after they have their, does that need to be in our motion?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, either that or what, bottom line, if you, either one of two ways, you can just put it in there, or if you want to, you can authorize Keith and I to make the basic conceptual offer, and we can try to negotiate terms with, it's Dennis Maloney, the lawyer up there who we're talking to, and see if we can find terms that they can stand and yet afford the customers the opportunity to take advantage of the stock if they want to.
Okay.
And I either way you want to do it. I mean, I don't think setting a 90-day option issuance limit or 6 months or any way you want to do it, I think. But on the other hand, if you want us to discuss that with the company as to what they think is fair, I don't think that's unreasonable either.
Okay.
And then I had a clarifying question for you, Chairman. In your motion, would you be instructing staff to make the disbursements on the claims, you know, immediately, or are we waiting to see what happens with this offer and then have one check?
My intention would be to have one check, and that there would be some minor delay. And given the line of questioning by Commissioner Colbeck, which I think is pretty good, and the question you just asked, it probably is appropriate to have some timeline for the commissions. I won't call it a counteroffer. I guess I'd call it an acceptance with conditions. And I'm certainly open to an amendment based on whatever time period anyone thinks is appropriate.
Are we talking the time period for acceptance?
For AFC's acceptance of our
okay.
essentially counteroffer.
What about 30 days? Is that too long of a time?
How long is the appeal?
The appeal is 30 days after the service of the notice, the order, in other words, is a notice of entry.
So we could certainly do 30 days without slowing down this process at all.
I think so, unless we think there's appeal rights, but I think everybody's defaulted at this point related to the stock, you know, but it's up to you, Relaine, if you don't think so, but nobody appeared.
They didn't appear.
So I don't think there is any appeal right related to that.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Does it affect your decision to, you know, July 22nd when both of these CDs will be mature? So if we could have everything, if we could set in our mind a timeline that acceptance, rejectance, and everything needs to be done, and we could cut one check, have everything done by July 22nd. Is that not reasonable?
Yeah, and we might be able to do it a lot. That's a deadline. We might be able to make it happen sooner than that.
I think we've got two potential deadlines. I mean, one deadline, two different time frames. One is the time frame, when do we want to get the money out of house here? And the secondly is, when do we want an answer from AFC? Because once we have an answer from them, there certainly would be all kinds of, if they accept, all kinds of activity between claimants, the commissions, and AFC to determine who wants to get stock and, you know, make sure we get our cash and the claimant's cash.
Ideally, my own belief would be this, that if we could do this, partially because it's Keith and I have told you that, and it probably sounds kind of, I don't know but the claimants are really sick of this, although they'll like it a lot better when they get a check, I think. But, what I was envisioning, honestly, is that they would get their check, and in that check would be this option, a stock option, which would be very simple for them to understand, and we require them just to sign this thing, include a check, and mail it back. And one of the other terms I think we should have on this is that there be no transactional costs other than the cost of that stamp to any of these people at all.
Right.
You know.
I would amend my motion to include a 30-day time limit on our counteroffer. And we'll put that on unless anybody has any opposition. Or any opposition, the motion will be amended. You know, I'll make just a couple of comments about why I think this is probably the right thing for the commission to do. The first is that, I mean, this ultimately brings some finality. I mean, I do think that there's a distinct possibility that 4 years from now these shares could be worth more than $100. But to me, people really deserve, the claimants deserve an end to this. This has been quite a long experience for everyone. And getting something now is probably better than something more later. The reason that I like the stock option is that it doesn't presume that the commission's right. It doesn't presume that the commission is contains all of the knowledge and all of the wisdom about stock valuation. We've received a number of opinions, both written and verbal, and there is great divergence about how much that stock should be valued at, and I don't have a clue what the right answer is. And so I think we should make available to the people information, the information we have on what the stock is worth, and let them decide. And that's why I think the motion's a good one.
Any other comments on the motion? Mr. Hansen.
As you were speaking, I don't recall the word that you used. I was thinking it was an odyssey that we have gone through, and the folks have gone through and waiting for whatever recourse and of justice that we can extract for them and provide to them. And I know that our staff has really put in a lot of work on this, and I'm sure all three of us appreciate that tremendously, on the professionalism and the amount of reading and research that they have had to do in order to provide this for us. And I appreciate very much, Mr. Chairman, your making the motion the way you did, and accepting the discourse. As I think it's a very fair, sensible resolution. I think it is the best resolution to this challenge. I appreciate Commissioner Kolbeck's suggestions on the time limits, and from the standpoint of the disbursements, I agree 100% that we should attempt in every way we can to make it in one check, as opposed to trying to send out a second mailing where they might get a nickel or something of that nature. I really have to agree. I really want to continue, believe it or not, to negotiate on this. I just don't feel that we're getting quite the money that we should for the 35 shares. At the same time, we could spend another $3,000 of the taxpayers' money and maybe get another $200, $400, or maybe reach a loggerhead where they capitulate to the point where we don't get anything. And the shareholders, folks that have been injured have to wait for 5 or 10 years before anything happens. So it's just as Mr. Shepik stated, what we know now, and it's somewhat of a Babe Ruth-ism or whatever, it's Yogi Berra, excuse me, we know what we know, and everything else is blind to us. And we've done our due diligence. We've completed it properly. We have responsibility to the taxpayers as well as to the folks that we've been fighting for here. And I think our staff has done the best job that we could expect of them and that the citizens could expect of them. And so I will definitely be supporting the motion.
Prior to moving toward a vote, perhaps we'll pause and see if our advisors, Mr. Islov, Ms. Wiest, have anything else we should consider prior to taking action.
I don't.
Any further discussion by commissioners?
No. I just wanted to state that thank you, staff, for time. And Mr. Shippick's comment made up my mind, one that you can't, that we offered it to them and they themselves didn't want to buy their own shares back. And Keith's statement, I put a lot of weight in Keith, and saying that is not our decision to make on what people want to invest in. So I think this motion takes care of both those issues.
Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote on the motion. Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Are there any other issues that we should be dealing with regard to this docket at this time? And Mr. Smith, you worked so hard to type up a motion, and I didn't even look at it.
I think we're fine.
Okay.
I just wanted to have something just in case, and so I just typed something up in case it could be useful, and it didn't turn out to be needed. Thank you very much. I thought your motion was fine.
Do you want a quick moment to review your motion to make sure we haven't forgotten anything?
I don't think so. I mean, I think fairly you stated that you were approving or granting our motion. And most of the things that I have in here are just some of those details, you know, from that initial paragraph, initial section A and then the numbered paragraph. So I think we're fine.
Thank you very much. With that, we will stand adjourned.